Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee. Welcome everybody here this morning, the place to be. We have a bill up first for public hearing and possible work session, House Bill 3656. Imagine if you would give us the overview. I'll open that public hearing on House Bill 3656.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3656 is a bill introduced last week. And primarily it deals with two main issues, raising fees on the securities licensing and broker dealers and investment advisors. And the other issue that it deals with is business registry at the Secretary of State. To go on the first one, the fees that are at this point administered by DCBS, Consumer and Business Services. It talks about enforcement of Oregon laws and so on of these licensing. I've put those into your packet. There's three major categories that are involved in here. The licensing is the first major category. Second one is securities registration, and then the federally the federal covered securities. What the bill does is takes those up from the old fee that has been in existence since 69, I believe, 1969, into a rulemaking authority by DCBS to find what is termed as the estimated midpoint fee from the National Securities Commission. That will take those fees from $100 and $50 and $15 and so on into multiples of those fees. And as you see from Exhibit B1 in your packet, you will find a stipulation of those different fees. As in licensing, there is 10 different fees, and there's 3 in the securities registration, and about 5 in the federally covered securities. By doing so, this will increase the amounts that are in existence are going to the general fund from only $4 million today after it pays for its costs and so covers everything else for the business. $4 million are transferred to the general fund. That will increase as a result of the new fee to about 19 to 21 million in the 03-05 biennium. Now the second category, big category of fees that I was talking about at this time is the business registry with the Secretary of State office. The business registry in the past, it was set on a schedule of fees going from $20 all the way to $800, depending on the type. In the 1999 session, those fees were all brought into one $20 fee for all the different license or registry. However, it did not make the new fee effective until 2001. And all things work in that way, that in 2001 everything went down and also the fee went down with it. In Exhibit A that I include with your package, you would see the transactions for business industry as they were in 1998 and 99 and 2000, and you see the drop as a result of the recessionary pressures that we've experienced in the year 2000. And also by the year 2001, with the reduction of the fee and the main or the streamlining of the fee, you see an increase of those registrations. The bill proposes going from $20 as exists today and increasing that by 30. That brings the total fee to about $50. Well, exactly $50. And they, however, there are other fees, and those fees are a compilation of things I have to mention: that professional corporation, business corporations, cooperatives, limited liability companies, non-profit corporations, and partnerships and limited partnerships. There are, while discussing these issues with the Secretary of State Corporation Division, we find that there are certain fees within the Corporation Division that are subsidized today by this $20 that is paid on the business registry. Mainly those are the UCC filing fees and notary filing fees, and those are subsidized to the tune of about 50%. The new fee will generate about $11 million for the 2003-05 biennium, and then a little more in the 2005-07. The setup that is arranged for this is to have a sub-account for the fees coming into that sub-account as revenue, then give the flexibility to the Secretary of State to pay for costs, and the net amounts will go to the general fund. However, that accounting model is probably seems to be not the most comfortable for the Secretary of State at this time. With the total revenue impact for the bill, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, adding all these things together, we are looking at about $22.34 million in 2003-05 and about $36.5 million in the 2005-07 biennium. And the exhibits, the last exhibit, B2, is worthy to mention that the fees in this bill are assumed to start in January 1st, 2004. However, there are a certain number of broker fees and so on that usually are due before the 31st. If those are done before that time, Exhibit B2 shows that there will be more amounts coming in the 2003-05 biennium by pulling the date back, but this is not part of the main documents. The exhibit here is just for your information.
All right. Thank you, Mazin. Let's bring up first Senator Vicki Walker. And did you want to have Floyd Lander up with you?
Yes.
Okay. Come on forward. Welcome to the House Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a delight to be in front of your committee, especially on this bill that originated in the Senate, as Senate Bill 826. I see you've done a little work on it, adding some extra things. And before I go any further, I'll identify myself. Vicki Walker, State Senator from District 7. And seated to my left will speak in a moment is Floyd Lanter, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I'd like to point out that when we had Senate Bill 826 drafted, we had an amendment drafted to it that did not make it into your redraft, which sets the implementation date of the securities fees increase at December 1, and that would capture the additional funds that would be pretty significant. So I would ask that in your consideration of this bill that you would consider doing that. I had Senate Bill 826 drafted this year, and I'm glad it's made it over here in this form in 3656. I met with the department in December of last year. Ed Russo, a business reporter for the Eugene Register Guard, my local newspaper, it is called The Register Guard these days, wrote a two-part series of articles in December on investment options and stock offerings that had lost people a significant amount of money. So I called the department and set up a meeting, and they came to Eugene to meet with me to talk about what kind of changes we could make that would make this a safer environment for people to put their money into. The department agreed to do some things that they could do without legislative authority. And then one of the things that we talked about was the fact that our securities fees are so incredibly low compared to the rest of the country. And so I, after that meeting, asked them to assist me in preparing some legislation for this session, and that's what you have before you. The fees, you'll hear argument from Mr. Roger Martin, because he did come in front of our Business and Labor Committee in the Senate and testify in opposition to the bill. And I can easily dispense with some of the arguments, actually all of the arguments that he raises in opposition, and I'll do that in a moment. And the bill, we did finally pass it out of our Senate Business and Labor Committee to Ways and Means because people began to realize that it was a worthwhile piece of legislation. All session long, whenever we had anyone appear in front of our Senate Business and Labor Committee, and they were licensed individuals in the state of Oregon, I would ask them how much they pay for a license. And it was just incredible to find the range of fees, and nowhere near did they approach $15 to be registered as a stockbroker. And a stockbroker deals with people's money and their financial future. And $15 seems like a paltry fee to be registered as someone who deals with that. And Mr. Lanter can, I'm not going to steal his thunder, but he can tell you some of the other fees that are in this state currently for other professions. And I can tell you as a court reporter, I even register, and it's $100 every 2 years, so that's $50 a year. So I'm actually paying more than a stockbroker currently. I did ask the department to contact all of as many organizations that are connected to the securities industry as possible. They did that by email. I actually spoke directly with the Securities Industry Association. I called them in advance, talked with them, and they said, well, while we don't like to see our members' fees increase, they understand the fees in Oregon are among the lowest, and therefore they'll remain neutral on the bill. I also, there was testimony in our Senate Business and Labor Committee from Peter Toll, Financial Planning Association of Oregon and Southwest Washington, and he said, we reluctantly support this bill. We believe the fees are not excessively onerous, and I quote, we feel it our duty as responsible Oregon citizens to help pay our fair share of the financial burden required for the state to properly regulate us. And that was a direct quote out of his testimony. And those of you who have served with me before know that I take very good notes. So we had, and I also asked Peter Toll and the other gentleman who testified with him, you folks have been in the business a long time. I said, you know, the last time Oregon raised these fees was in 1967 and 69. I would expect that you have raised your fees in the last 30 years, and the answer was yes. So it was really great to turn the tables on them and know that, yes, indeed, we have raised our fees. Now, I'd like to just briefly address some of the arguments of Mr. Martin. He states in his letter, which I suspect that you have, that since when does Oregon determine how to treat its businesses by looking at how other states do? Well, I would say that we should do that because Oregon shouldn't be at the bottom of the list. Many of the other states have done the same thing that we have. We're all looking for ways to fill budget holes, but we're all looking at ways to make sure that the cost of business is taken care of. And I actually don't think it should be less than other states. We're asking to raise this to the median point. We're not asking to have the highest fees in the nation or the lowest. We'd like to be in the midpoint. And actually, I would tell you that if Oregon had been raising its fees consistently since 1969, we would probably be where we are at today. So that's why it looks like such a big increase, because we've waited so darn long. And by giving the department the authority to do this on their own with public hearings, I think that just it keeps it from coming back here for us to give approval. I think once we've done the approval, they have the wherewithal to get it done. The second point Mr. Martin raises is in some cases the fee increase using the national midpoint would be over 300% of the current fee. Well, you just have to look at some of the fee increases from $15 to $50, and there are numerous other examples. I don't think it's really actually that significant. And he also notes that historically the fees collected for licensing have been tied to the cost of regulating the licensed profession. Well, that's true, but I would also point out to you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that the department also, other state departments incur fees. In 2002, a civil case was filed by this department in Multnomah County Circuit Court involving 15 individuals or entities. That case used significant court staff time, space, and staff, and a trial date has for the unresolved portions of that has not yet been scheduled. And since January 2009, criminal cases have been referred to district attorneys in various counties for prosecution. Those prosecutions resulted in convictions in 5 of those cases, 1 acquittal, and 3 cases still pending. So you can see that general fund monies are expended through district attorney salaries and benefits, circuit court budgets, administration of the parole and probation officers program. So really, there are more uses for that fee, and they aren't directly paid. So I think, while Mr. Martin raises a point, I think I was able to tell you why that's really not a relevant point. Also, I would say that we're entitled to collect a fee for doing business in our state. That's the purpose of what we do here, because Mr. Martin raises an issue that these notice filing fees shouldn't be implemented. But we're asking for people to pay to do business here. Notice filing refers to fees paid for the privilege of doing business in Oregon, and that's what we're asking. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think we've made a pretty good case why the fees need to be increased, and I'd like Mr. Lanter to be able to give you some more detail.
Very good. Mr. Lanter.
Thank you, Chair Shelley and members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter, and I serve as the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We're a member of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here this morning to seek the committee support for House Bill 3656, specifically Sections 1 through 5, Section 8, and Section 9, and I believe you have a copy of my testimony in front of you. The securities licensing, securities registration, and notice filing fees that Oregon charges are used by the division to administer and enforce Oregon securities law. Revenues in excess of that required for the regulation and enforcement activities are transferred on a quarterly basis to the general fund. Our securities licensing and filing fees have not changed since the late 1960s and right now are close to or are the lowest of such fees being charged in the U.S., including the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. Whatever the basis was for setting those fees back in 1967 and 69, they no longer bear any resemblance to those currently charged by other jurisdictions in the U.S., and they pale against the value of securities offerings made in the state, suggesting that the securities industry has benefited since the fees were last adjusted. As a result, a significant source of general fund revenue has contributed far less than would otherwise be the case had the fees been set at a level at or near the national midpoints, which the bill is attempting to do. As an adjustment in the fees today will merely place Oregon in the mid-range compared to other jurisdictions with little impact to those paying the fees. Exhibit 1 on page 5 of my testimony provides examples of the major categories of securities licensing and registration activity and Oregon's relative standing. As you can see from the exhibit, an agent in Oregon pays $15 for their initial registration or license, and that compares to a high of $235 in Texas. Only Colorado charges less than Oregon for an agent license. The agent renewal and transfer license information is also presented in Exhibit 1 in that table. Below the agent information, I would point out the you'll see the broker-dealer initial registration. Here in Oregon, that costs $100, and that compares to a high in Puerto Rico of $500. Colorado and Utah are the only two states that charge less than Oregon. The broker-dealer renewal fee in that table is $50 in Oregon. That is, in fact, the lowest fee in the U.S. While that comparison is industry comparison is helpful, license fee data for other professional occupations provide an additional perspective. For example, an attorney here in Oregon pays an initial license fee of $482 for a two-year term and a like amount to renew that license. A CPA pays $300 for their initial license fee for a two-year term and $180 for a renewal. A land surveyor pays $285 for the initial fee and $240 to renew. And last, a real estate broker pays $230 for their initial license fee and a like amount for a renewal. This bill does not intend to bring security license fees to the highest in the nation. We merely intend to bring license fees to the national midpoint. With respect to registration of securities offerings, our minimum and maximum fee compared to the national midpoint for states with comparable fee structures are, for a minimum, it's $25 in Oregon. And if we look at comparable states, the national midpoint is $100. This is the lowest in the U.S. The same applies for the maximum fees for securities registration. The maximum fee in Oregon is $500, and compared to the national midpoint involving 19 states with comparable fee structures of $2,000. Again, we are the lowest in this area. House Bill 3656 amends the law to remove those minimum and maximum fees and permits the director to establish securities registration fees at the national midpoint. By doing so, Oregon will avoid volatility in the fee structure and keep from sliding to the bottom or rising to the top. And it will significantly increase revenue flow to the general fund from this modest but important source. Now, with respect to the impact of the general fund, with House Bill 3656, the overall increase in revenue for all securities-related fees available to transfer to the general fund would increase to about $12.6 million in the 03-05 biennium and to $21.4 million in the 05-07 biennium and $23.1 million in the 07-09 biennium. However, I would like to emphasize, as been mentioned earlier, that should the operative date of this bill coincide with the effective date, an additional $3.4 million would be available for transfer to the general fund, since our license renewals are processed by the division in December. And I've drafted and attached to my testimony a conceptual -1 amendment to Section 9 to accomplish this, the committee desires. In summary, by requiring the director to set securities fees by rules at the national midpoint, it will result in additional transfer to the general fund. It does not impose the kind of exorbitant fees that would restrict the range of offering or drive broker-dealers, salesperson, and advisors out of the market, and it will prevent Oregon from sliding to the bottom over time where we are now. So I respectfully request the committee support for Sections 1 through 5 and Section 8 and Section 9 with the conceptual -1 amendment, and that the bill be amended, as amended, be sent to the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leiter. Questions for either of these witnesses? Representative Scott.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And a couple questions for you, actually, three or four. What basis did you use for calculating the fee increases other than simply midpoint for what throughout the states are?
Chair Shelley, Representative Scott, we used information available from the self-regulatory organizations, the National Association of Securities Dealers, and the Investment Advisors Representative Board, and they have information available on their websites where they list or produce disinformation for all states, and that is what we use to determine what a midpoint would be for those projections that you have in front of you.
In some of the other fee increases that are being considered, there's been a process of determining what the fees would be should we have used the COLA basis to increase. Did we do any of that calculations to see where it would fall if we had used? Did you use any of the COLA costs?
Chair Shadley, Representative Scott, no, I'm not aware that we used any COLA back testing, if you will, to see what the impact would be. I suspect it would be even higher since it's been so long that these fees have been adjusted.
It didn't prove out that way in the other increases that we're contemplating, but it may in this one.
Sure.
We're talking about transferring these funds to the general fund. Has there been a transfer from your department to the general fund in the past?
Chair Shadley, Representative Scott, yes. In 2002, it was approximately $2 million, and it would be about the same this year, about $4 million currently during a biennium.
And one more?
You bet.
What was the ending balance of the 0103 in your department?
Chair Shadley, Representative Scott, for the securities area?
Or both.
I don't have that information in front of me right now. I can get that information and get back to you.
And in calculating that, if I may, in calculating that, do you also calculate what fund you need to have as an operating?
Chair Shadley, Representative Scott, yes, the department has a funds balance policy that we're required to follow. In the case of the security section in the division, we're required to maintain a minimum of 2 quarters fund balance comparable to the expenditures that we would incur during those 2 quarters. And so that's the department looks at that and determines where we're at with respect to that policy and then transfers those funds on a quarterly basis to the general fund.
So you keep 6 months' worth of operating cash?
Correct.
And one more question,
yes.
And that's it. collecting these fees, I noticed that you want to change it to a December 1, 2003. Throughout your department, what's the collection dates? Are they all annual, or do they spread throughout the entire year?
Chair Shadley, Representative Scott, we're talking about a wide variety of fees. The license fees for the agents, the investment advisors, and the broker dealers, most of that is handled electronically through national services, and that takes place in December for the most part. Now, the registrations and stuff like that occur all throughout the year.
That leads me to several other questions.
Okay.
But in doing that transfer, or not transfer, but in doing the collection process that collect throughout the year, if we've transferred monies throughout the last bienniums or quarters, I think, as you referred to, and we have sufficient cash flows to do that, we retain 6 months' worth of operating cash, and we still transfer money. Other than the theory or the basis of saying we just need to be at the median rate, why would we need to increase the fees?
Chair Shadley, Representative Scott, really, all we're making available to the general fund an additional source of revenue. We currently do cover our operating expenses with the existing fee structure, which is the lowest in the country.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, if I might add to that.
Sure.
We increased fees on tobacco last special session, and I think there's talk about doing that again. We raise more than we need. We put it in the general fund for other purposes. We do that throughout the spectrum here, and I don't think it's unreasonable. As Mr. Toll said, we feel it our duty as responsible Oregon citizens to help pay our fair share. I don't think it's an unreasonable share to ask them. And also, as I pointed out, there are other costs involved for this department that really reflect it.
Well, it's the general fund impact of this bill that requires the three-fifths majority. If it was just a fee bill, it wouldn't require a three-fifths majority. If it was just for the cost of doing business. But it is, in fact, because this is intended to transfer funds to the general fund, that it does require a three-fifths majority for passage.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Anything else?
Well, Mr. Chair, I did have one thing I wanted to add,
okay,
if I might. One of the things I talked about with the department was, and I didn't have it drafted as an amendment, so I just want to throw it out to you all to think about. I wanted to dedicate one half of 1%, or $250,000, whichever is greater, to the Department of Consumer Business Services to promote financial education. For me, I think that is a very high priority. There was an article in my paper in May of 2003 that called us the United States a nation of financial illiterates. And I would strongly concur with that, that we are a nation that does not save. We don't know how to do that. We don't have financial education programs in most of our schools anymore because of budget cuts. And we have people going to payday lenders and car title lenders and racking up significant credit card debt to the point that we have, for several sessions of Congress now, the credit card industry wants to reform the bankruptcy system in which I practice as a court reporter. They want to make it more difficult for people to discharge those credit card debts in bankruptcy. And I submit to you that the credit card companies have a lot to do with that by mailing those kinds of solicitations out to people and granting them pretty readily. So I just want you to think about that. I know you want every penny for the general fund, but it wouldn't be too significant of a diversion to put some money into financial education.
All right. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a comment on the last comment of the good senator, and that is that I believe that people who are well-educated in terms of handling their own finances have the tools necessary to understand much better than others the relationship between program and taxes in our budgets as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us. What I want to do now is recess the public hearing on House Bill 3656. We have two more witnesses, Roger Martin and Peter Threlkell. If I can ask you gentlemen to wait, we've got some folks who came in from out of the building to catch up on testimony that we missed yesterday on House Bill 2837. And since those folks had to drive down to the Capitol to be here with us today, I want to make sure we hear an interesting one. Representative Farr, do you have that on your phone?
That's a new one.
I'm still
Monday. Oh, okay. Monday. Okay. So we will recess the public hearing on House Bill 3656. And open a work session on House Bill 2837 just for the purpose of catching up on the testimony that we missed yesterday. And I think I've got the list here. Let's see. There looks like one that we didn't get at the end of the day yesterday. Is this Bruce Piper and Ulick and Rick Trelevin?
They asked to come.
All right. Okay, one very good and one close. Well, all right.
Chair Shellery, members of the committee, thank you for taking some additional testimony today. This is the third day I've driven from Roseburg to be here and testify, and I couldn't make it a fourth day. My name is Bruce Piper. I'm the CEO of ADAPT, a private company that provides addictions treatment throughout several communities in Southwest Oregon. I'm testifying today not only on behalf of my company, but also the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Directors Association of Oregon, which is a trade association of private companies, about 45 of us, that contract with health plans and provide addictions treatment throughout the state. I need your direct involvement for a moment in the testimony this morning. I've passed out what I hope will be a light moment, a committee quiz. Now, if you're prone to test anxiety, let me tell you the quick rules here. First, you grade your own quiz. Secondly, you don't have to share your answers. Third, you can look on your neighbor's paper. And fourth, you can cheat as much as you want if you really need to.
Perfect for the legislation.
Good.
We're with you.
I knew I was in the right place. First question. Approximately, what will be the cost of the OHP in the coming biennium? Second question. What are three of the top 10 cost drivers of the Oregon Health Plan? Third, and this gets a little personal, what was your monthly health insurance premium in 1977 and now? What did you pay for rent in 1977? Two more. Has professional malpractice gone up more or less than 100% in the last 25 years? And last, in President Carter's first 6 months in office, what was the price of a gallon of gas? Okay. Answer number one, you know better than I. I have no idea. All I know is it's a whole lot of money and that you're struggling mightily to figure that one out.
That was easy.
No one knows.
No one knows. Number two. Number two. Three of the 10 largest cost drivers are hepatitis C, low birth weight, and liver transplants, all three directly related to substance abuse. What was your monthly health insurance premium in 1977? Boy, I have no idea. I know for my company, for employees that have families and they have to contribute part of the cost of this, it's just inched up over $1,000 a month. What'd you pay for rent in 77? I don't remember that either. I got married in 1979. It was $185 for a two-bedroom apartment. Malpractice insurance definitely has gone up over 100%. We, of course, as businesses, pay that to provide the professional services that we deliver. And a gallon of gas, I'm guessing 65 to 75 cents in 1977. The point here, of course, is simply to frame for a moment how much costs have gone up, how much things have changed since 1977. The private companies that contract throughout Oregon to provide the bulk of addictions treatment services rely heavily on beer and wine tax revenues to do that. The purchasing power of these dollars has been declining for 25 years. Think of what you made in 1977. Now think of being a business trying to pay your 2003 bills with that revenue. I agree very much with the testimony yesterday that perspective is very important here. 44 states have a higher beer tax. Many of the points you heard yesterday were also put forth originally by the industry when the tax was created in the mid-70s. I think we're all glad, though, that in spite of that, the industry has flourished in this state. As one who very much wants to see the industry continue to flourish, it's nice to see that the existing exemption has worked so well. In the last 6 months, I've laid off 30% of my employees. This is a larger percentage than Roseburg Forest Products, despite their dramatic downsizing. Other private treatment companies have laid off as much as half of their workforce. It was interesting yesterday to hear that there were approximately 3,600 employees in the microbrew industry statewide. In the last 6 months, over 1,800 alcohol and drug and mental health employees have had their jobs eliminated. All of these positions had caseloads rich with referrals from DHS and corrections. I really want to emphasize that at least with respect to alcohol and drug services, these are private jobs that have been lost. My employees' morale is very important to me. I'm very concerned about it. We've been successful because of our ability to recruit and retain. For instance, the top three positions in our company now has a total of 52 years tenure. For the last 3 years, Oregon Business Magazine has chosen us as one of the top 100 businesses to work for in Oregon. Because we're a small business, we actually are one of the top 50 in the small business category. We're proud of this. After what we've been through in the last few months, it's going to be very interesting to see what my workforce has to say about us in the coming year's competition. It's a little bit hard to visually represent the amount of the current tax because, as we know, the United States does not make currency and denomination smaller than a cent. The tax was established in the mid-70s at about 0.8 cents. That's what it is to this day. Yesterday I was scratching my head a little bit as I was listening to people talk about this being a dramatic 381% increase. And then I realized that it was being framed that way basically for rhetorical purposes, for shock of value or shock effect. And I thought, well, you know, if the tax in 1977 had been 0.1 cents, and we were talking about raising it now to 0.8 cents, horror of horrors, that would be an 800% increase, twice the 381 that was mentioned yesterday. The point is that it is so small now and has been so small for so long that any meaningful increase will be a large percentage. An industry lobbyist has stated in print that his goal is for Oregon to move from being almost dead last to dead last in taxing beer. I fear that if we don't pass this bill, we will quickly close in on his goal. From my daily vantage point, that is not a particularly good trade-off for Oregon. What do I mean by a trade-off? Alcohol and drug treatment programs are desperately used as the primary solution for the caseloads of DHS agencies and corrections. If you talk to almost any of their managers, at least they tell us 70 to 80% of their caseloads are populated by people with serious substance abuse problems. The trade-off? Well, since last October, admissions to outpatient treatment statewide have dropped by half. By half. Precisely at a time when those caseloads have gone up in DHS with these very people, our ability to treat them has dropped like a rock. 2 months ago, Douglas County set a record for the number of children that SCF put into foster care. Almost every one of those cases involved parental substance abuse. Of the 52 families referred to us for treatment, only 17 of them had any public funding to help offset the cost of treatment. In Coos County, where I provide services in Representative Verger's district, where they recently started leading Oregon in the per capita cases of child abuse, the cuts to public funding resulted in me eliminating half of the treatment staff. The waiting list for Coos services this summer has been about 3 months just for an assessment. Now note that many of the women that are referred to us through the SCS system are facing permanent termination of parental rights where their children will become wards of the state. They only have 12 months, according to federal and state law, to achieve a clean and sober lifestyle, and the clock is ticking. Having so little treatment capacity virtually guarantees that many, many of these children are going to end up wards of the state and thereby drive up SCF's foster care costs. What's hard is to watch this knowing we can succeed. My background includes being the CEO of a multi-specialty surgery center. I know a little bit about healthcare outcomes. I know that our outcomes in this treatment industry parallels, rivals, and exceeds in some instances the management and treatment of other chronic diseases, for instance, diabetes, hypertension, asthma. One example from my own program, we've had a drug court program since 1996 for 7 years. In order to graduate, you have to be clean and sober for 6 months. That's established by multiple urinalysis tests on a weekly basis that are unannounced. We've had 276 graduates. In order to get in this program, you have to basically be a felon with a lengthy history of substance abuse. 276 graduates. Now, as a taxpayer, as a policymaker, me as a taxpayer, that number of graduates, what would we be happy with in terms of an outcome? Half of these people wouldn't get rearrested? Personally, I would be happy with that. I would think that would be a significant success given how difficult the population is. We've had 18 rearrests in 7 years. That's not my internal data. That's the state of Oregon law enforcement data system. You have before you, I believe, an elegant policy choice. Have people who consume too much pay for the treatment capacity they need. Citizens self-select the amount they pay. If you don't consume much, it has a minimal impact. Every chamber of commerce in Oregon and every business magazine you read reiterate that businesses' taxes are of necessity passed on to the consumer. This is a user fee. We connect the dots in Oregon on the gas tax to pay for roads. We connect the dots in Oregon with tobacco revenue to help pay for health care. We connect the dots in Oregon for fishing and hunting tags and license fees to help pay for the ODFW. It's a great choice for us to do a better job of connecting the dots here to have consumption of the beverage that is by volume far the largest help pay for some of the damage that we have to deal with, and that as taxpayers we all foot the bill for by creating some more treatment capacity. Not connecting the dots just perpetuates basically a subsidy. Each year the cost of doing business measured against inflation has effectively declined in Oregon, for especially the out-of-state brewers. We're not asking anybody to catch up with 25 years of inflation here. We're asking that you keep from further disassembling the alcohol and drug treatment system. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's hear from the rest of the panel, then we'll take any questions or comments from you.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rick Trelevin, and I'm the Executive Director of Best Care Treatment Services in Central Oregon. I'm also the Mental Health Director for Jefferson County, and I'm here also representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. So the proposal before you is one of many that have been floated in this legislature about a beer increase. And so what I've tried to do, I've heard a lot of economic discussion about this that and predictions of economic disaster and job loss. And some of it, frankly, didn't make any sense to me. So I decided to do a little common sense analysis of this proposal myself. And so with this, I've made some assumptions. I assumed a 5 cent per drink added tax. Now, if we assume no exemptions, the proposed tax would be the same for cheap beer or the boutique beers. And on a relative basis, the cheaper beer would be taxed more, the tax being a greater proportion of their overall price. The paradoxical result of the tax, this assuming no exemption for smaller brewers, would be that the relative price difference between the local brew and the national beers would be less. This is how it works. I did a survey of the Redmond Safeway recently, and it showed that a 12-ounce long neck from Budweiser, Coors, or Miller, they all cost the same, was 78 cents a beer. This is assuming you're buying a six-pack. And I turned around and found the Deschutes Brewery Mirror Pond Ale, which cost $1.25 per beer. So currently, the local quality beer currently costs 60% more than the beer from the national brewers. A 5 cent beer tax applied equally to cheap or boutique beers would raise the costs to 83 cents and $1.30 respectively. This means that a tax on the cheap beers would raise their price to by 6.4%. And the local beers would go up 3.8%. So that would be a small but significant advantage for the local beers. Now, if you assume the current proposal, which is an exemption for the local beers, or the small brewers, rather, then what we have is a tax that actually protects local Oregon jobs. The costs at the Safeway Redmond for the national beer would go up 6.4%, while the price of the locally produced beer would remain unaffected. The local beer then would be priced only 50% more than the national brand. And this would be a definite advantage, lowering the difference, and thus creating theoretically more local jobs. I also began to think about the market niche of the local brewers. The market niche of the local brewers tend to have more disposable income and tends to put more premium on taste. That 13% of the market that is buying boutique beers are the least price-sensitive group in the market. We know that the most price-sensitive consumers, and those are the ones I'm primarily concerned about, and those are the ones drinking for volume and underage drinkers. They're already drinking the cheap beers. They're not going after the local brews. Here's what makes the beer tax compelling. Here's the single most important thing that makes it compelling. 10% of the drinkers consume 50% of the alcohol in this country. The local brewers, to their credit, do not attract and do not market to the small minority of drinkers who put away a six-pack or two six-pack a day. As a result, we would expect the local brewers will not lose any market share to the nationals, and that no jobs would be lost in Oregon because of this tax. If anything, they would gain market share. Going back to that 10%, these are the social costs. This minority of drinkers, this 10%, who consume 50% of the alcohol, create huge social costs for the rest of us that we all pay. In fact, this minority of drinkers are the primary cost drivers for social services. The majority of criminal justice, child welfare cases involve serious alcohol abuse. Much of the unreimbursed medical care that hospitals provide is for accidents due to alcohol abuse. The general public, you and me, we already pay a hidden tax in increased health insurance rates and higher crime rates due to this small minority of drinkers. So what we have in the proposal before you is a user tax, which is uniquely progressive tax because the more you drink, the more you pay. So in economics, it's usually better that the people who create the costs also have to pay for them. This beer tax functions as a user tax. It would be an insignificant expense to the vast majority of drinkers. Heavy drinkers and alcoholics, helping to offset the costs they create for the rest of us, would pay the majority of the tax. The moderate drinker, say someone who averages a beer a day, 365 in a year, would pay about $18 a year in the tax. Now, in my residential programs, I ask the people, how much do you drink in a day? And their starting amount is two six-packs. That gets them through the day, so 12 beers a day. Those people, if we assume that they're just doing their starting drinking, they would pay $219 a year for this tax. So exactly the people who are creating the social costs are the people who would end up paying this tax. The key thing is that the revenue from the tax would then need to be dedicated to treatment, prevention, medical, and police services that can help decrease the social costs of alcohol abuse and alcoholism. And all these services, mind you, have been severely cut in the past 6 months of the budget crisis. So here's the bottom line. On close analysis, the claims of economic disaster and job losses if the beer tax passes do not play out. A 5 cent a drink beer tax makes economic sense. Frankly, I'll say a 7 cent beer tax makes a lot of sense, too. It protects local jobs and has a minority of the problem drinkers help pay for the costs that they create for the rest of us. I am the proud graduate, class of 77, of Sprague High here in Salem, Oregon. You will note the lovely color schemes that we impose and torture the current children of that school.
Looks like the Senate wing.
Maybe it was your salt.
Well, then it's good that you're on the House side. You're not tortured as badly. And so I would note that I am currently a graybeard, and the tax has not been raised since I graduated from high school here. So I think after 26 years, it's time that we have an increase in the beer tax. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Uller. 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 Okay, sorry.
That's all right. Chair Shetterly and committee members, my name is Ann Uller. I'm here to speak as a representative and a founding member of the Women's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Issues in the state of Oregon. The commission would like, it's going to be kind of short and sweet, I hope, would like to give you three reasons why you should vote for this. And the first one is that by increasing the beer tax to support drug and alcohol treatment, you'll save up to $7 for each dollar spent. Therefore, it's a wise investment. Making wise investments is being a good steward of the tax dollars, and you are the steward of our tax dollars. An example of this wise investment is the savings in foster care. You heard a little about that already, but we want you to know we looked at a statewide, because we're an advocacy group, we look at the statewide services for women. And when we multiplied using what we thought was a very conservative figure of 90 new kids would have to go into foster care because they're not getting outpatient, their mothers are not getting outpatient treatment since last March. 90 new kids a month. That will cost the state $25 million more this biennium because of that decision to not have those women covered under the health plan. That's only one of the hydraulics. You've heard some of the other hydraulics, but one of them. That's what it's going to cost you. It's costing you now because this started in March. So as a good investment, if you raise the tax, there, and it has to go to treatment in order to get this investment, you will save yourself money in foster care, $25 million. Okay, that's the first reason. The second reason to vote for this is that 71% of Oregonians, voters, favor a 5% increase in the beer tax. If 5 cents a drink, what did I say? 5 cents a drink, sorry. If it goes to drug abuse treatment, prevention, and mental health programs. And that's according to a survey, a 2002 survey by Davis, Hibbets, and McKay in January of 2002. So that's another reason. Most voters approve this. Good reason to approve this in the state legislature. And then third, it's a little more obtuse, but I hope you'll get this. And that is that when you increase the beer tax to support treatment, it sends a message that this chronic illness is treatable and as important as other illnesses. Therefore, reducing the stigma that's associated with the illness. This stigma creates great shame and acts as a barrier for women to get into recovery. In closing, we'd like to suggest one change in the bill. Because we're a state advocacy group, it's very hard for us even now to get a handle on the services for women in the state. Unfortunately, what happens in this bill is that this bill all goes to the majority of it goes to counties and cities. And so that's going to be even harder for us to keep track. And now we're going to have to go to 36 counties to figure out what's going on with women's services in the state. So a suggestion we have is a small accountability clause be added. And that is that a report comes back to the legislature through the Department of Human Services in their budget report. So if the counties and cities then they're supposed to spend this money related to drug and alcohol. But there's right now, even in the current statute, there's no accountability. So do they do it? Unless somebody goes around to 36 counties and finds out how that money's spent, there's no accountability right now. So we're asking that a small accountability clause get added so that you get next time a report about, is this money actually going to be spent on the very things that this increase was supposed to go for? It would also help, as a member of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug, it would also help them prepare their plan for services in the state. So thank you very much for both the invitation and the chance to speak today, and hope you'll remember the three reasons for voting for an increase in the beer tax.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments for this panel? We have several other witnesses I want to get through. Representative Bunhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is directed mostly at Mr. Piper. You've described this public-private partnership that your company is involved in. And you've also mentioned malpractice insurance, which I take it is an important component for financial management in your business. Would you take a moment to describe some of the risks that are involved in the operation of this kind of a business?
Certainly. We've experienced a lot of reductions in funding just recently, but over the long term, and I'm most familiar with just with Southwest Oregon, for instance, detox and residential programs have closed in Roseburg, in Coos Bay, in Grants Pass, in Medford, in Klamath Falls, and in Bend. That's before these reductions. This is a system that's difficult from the private sector to partner with government to do because of what the funding levels have historically been. The cuts in the last several months have disproportionately impacted this system. It's just, sometimes people ask me, why would you want to continue to do this? And we do scratch our heads occasionally and ask ourselves that question. I guess another example of risk is, like any insurance company or any major health provider like a hospital, we often accept capitated contracts, which means that we have a finite amount of money that we have to work with, and whoever comes in the door, we're responsible to treat. Okay. Maybe a personal example of risk, in the over 20 years I've been in my position, I've watched 9 private providers come and go and go out of business in Coos County. 2 years ago, when the community asked ADAPT to come there, we came with a lot of fear and trembling after that kind of a track record. So, we've always looked at ourselves, and I'm not talking about myself so much as our trade association, as a primary solution for Oregon in an interesting way of human services being provided in the private sector. We're not talking about, we have PERS here. We're talking about private jobs. And like Aaron, there's risks. And, yes, we of course, are, paying directors and officers insurance, professional liability, malpractice, all the kind of normal costs that a business has.
Yeah, do you want to address that?
As a former director of a program, I just want to talk about the risk of treating people who have many medical and mental health complications as well, which drives your cost up.
Yeah.
And for women's programming, who also have their children in the residence, you have additional costs because you've got young preschool children, many young preschool children in the treatment center. And, of course, you're going to have accidents, all of those kinds of things. So the malpractice and just your regular business insurance has shot up because of those risks.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Berger, you have something?
Yes. Mine is more of a comment and probably in response to Mr. Piper. I started working in Coos County on the war against drugs before 1975. Spent about 20 years doing it. We now have a bigger problem than we had when I started.
Yeah.
We also put a lot of money into it and have over 20 years. So I have my own little test for you.
I'm ready.
Drugs in Oregon decreased since 1977. Is treatment without residential facilities, successful? Do we have more residential facilities in Oregon since 1977? Are most alcoholics addicted only to beer or also to hard liquor? And does it cost more to put people in treatment today than it did in 1977? So you know all the answers to those. But those are some of the things that I want to say. Money is not the answer. I want to compliment all three of you for the work that you do. You are working in one of the most challenging areas and the most destructive social areas in Oregon. We need to get a handle on the war on drugs so your goal can be to work yourselves out of a job instead of a job that's just increasing to the point that no one can afford it. And I want to say to Ann, I appreciate very much your accountability clause. It's an extremely important part of this whole money track that we put into the war against drugs as well as the treatment for drugs. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We need to move on. I want to thank this panel for coming forward. Committee, we will break at 10:30, and I know we have several people who want to testify, so if I could... Senator Morissette, you wandered in. Do you want to speak to us? Okay, let me bring you up. We've also got... I've got names here. Carl Ockert, I guess Paula Troyer, Jim Parker, Jamie Floyd, Gordon Foltz, Gina Furman, Ellen Lowe, Marianne Schwab, and Barry Fenimore. Are you all still here? Okay, well, we'll get through as fast as we can here. Senator.
Thank you very much. For the record, Bill Morissette, Senator from Lynn Lane County, Senate District 6, here to testify in support of House Bill 2837. The material that I'm distributing has House Bill 2804 listed at the top. Which is Senator, our Representative Butler's bill. This 2837, I understand, is Representative Williams. A number of us have worked together on this issue over time, actually for the last couple sessions. I think it's more important facing our current budget deficit. What we have is a breakdown. We've had a lot of iterations of this particular measure. This is a 7 cent per drink, and the front page is for, with the exemption of small breweries. The second page is without the exemption. The bottom line is in this biennium, $104 million, 2007, $151 million. And you can see how the money is distributed. This is, of course, a suggestion. This has been worked out with the various groups that have been participating, including, well, the prevention community, law enforcement, and so on. We did celebrate the 26th anniversary of the Oregon Beer Tax on June 28th. And I want to give you a little bit of information about that. It passed the Oregon Beer Tax passed by a vote of 48-11, and at that time there was no three-fifths majority, but it would not have mattered because we did have there was a significant support for it. It was signed by Governor Straub among the Democrats who voted on this bill.
Representative Earl Blumenhauer of Multnomah County, Representative Hardy Myers, Multnomah County, Representative May Yee of Linn County, and I'm sure May would be supportive if she were here today. Representative Ted Drulingowski of Lane and Douglas counties among the Republicans, Representative Dave Frohnmeyer from Lane County, the recently deceased Representative Kip Lombard from Jackson County, Representative Bill Rutherford, Yam Hill County, and Representative Gary Wilhelms of Klamath County. So it did have a broad-based support 26 years ago. You've heard adequate testimony, I think, this morning. I'm not going to repeat what has been said, although I think it's extremely important that we go to the source of a lot of the problems that we're having in society. And I think that it's justified. I would recommend a 7-cent a drink increase. And with that, I will end and be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Any questions for the Senator? All right, thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
All right, let's bring up Carl Ockert, Paula Troyer, and Jim Parker.
Good morning, Representative Shirley and Council. My name is Carl Ockert. I'm the brewmaster at the Bridgeport Brewing Company. We've been making craft brewery beers here in Oregon for 20 years now, and we are now Oregon's oldest brewery of any size. We've seen our company rise in sales from zero to whopping 975 barrels in our first year of production, and we anticipate sales of about 40,000 barrels this year. We are a growing, vibrant company. We're part of a growing, vibrant industry in this state. And I like to just come forward and say that the economics is a web, and it isn't just us that's affected by this. It's the people that we employ, the people that we employ directly, the people we employ indirectly. We've gone from one employee in 1984, which is me, to 90 employees currently. Directly, we have a payroll of $2.1 million annually. These are good family wages. About half of them are good family wages with full benefits. Half of them are service-type jobs. We support indirectly and directly other facets of Oregon industry and agriculture. We buy tens of thousands of hops that are grown here in the valley close by. We buy hundreds of thousands of pounds of Oregon barley that are grown south of us in the Klamath Falls area. We support Oregon industry. We purchase the bottles that you put by your curbside. Those get put in, made into other bottles, and that's what we purchase. We purchase millions of beer bottles a year. These are made at a glass plant by the Portland Airport that employs thousands of people, all being paid good company wages. We buy cardboard packaging that's being produced in Northeast Portland. Once again, it's part of that web of how our influence spreads in the Oregon economy. These are people that are Oregonians that have got good-paying jobs. We've expanded our brewery several times in the course of our growth. In doing that, we've purchased over $1 million worth of tanks and equipment made by a manufacturer down in Canby, Oregon. We've supported Oregon construction and union craft jobs throughout those expansions. This is money going back into the economy. But in 2002, we supported the Oregon government by paying $56,000 in Oregon beer tax, and we supported the U.S. federal government by paying over $240,000 in federal beer tax. That's $300,000 in taxes, and that's money that couldn't go back into wages, couldn't go back into reinvestment. It's why we are against increasing the Oregon beer tax, because we think it singles out and harms our industry. It hurts us directly by increasing the cost of our products to customers. And I think, in opposition to the previous testimony, I don't think there's an economic argument for a tax increase being healthy for any kind of business. It's an extra cost of doing business. And when you increase cost, way back in Econ 101, we were taught, and we've seen many times since, when you increase costs, you decrease sales. Even the science majors were forced to take some business classes, and I think that was a pretty clear message even back then. Increases in taxes make continued investment in an Oregon business like ourselves less attractive and penalize further growth and expansion. This is a penalty. This is a growth penalty. It hurts us indirectly by increasing the cost of doing business to our business partners, which are the wholesalers and distributors in this state, who also employ thousands of people and bring our products to market. If they're harmed, we're harmed. It's as simple as that. I urge you to not harm what is a vibrant, growing industry here in Oregon. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Ms. Troyer, you've got the company shirt on. Are you all together?
No.
Okay, let's pick you up next then. I'm just guessing you're probably
right now. Before
8. Yeah.
My name is Paula Troyer. I'm the marketing manager with Bridgeport Brewing Company. We've been around for almost 20 years now, and kind of from the foundings of the company, we're based on, besides providing great craft beer, a strong foundation of heritage quality and community commitment. And we have made a significant investment over the years working with several community organizations and donations programs. For example, this past year we donated within community sponsorships and donations over $35,000 to community-related organizations. And with a tax increase, that will significantly decrease the amount that we are able to contribute to these organizations who have come to us in terms of donations and needs. We have worked with the Oregon Symphony, Portland Literary Arts, Portland Public Schools, First Octave, World Affairs Council, and each of these organizations gives back to the community. And we're also working with other organizations like the Portland, Oregon Visitors Association to help continue to bring in tourism, help promote things like the Oregon Brewers Festival, which brought in 80,000 people to the Portland metro area this past weekend. And each of those components are very important in helping give back to the community, promote and educate Oregon beer. And with the tax increase, it would significantly impact what we are able to contribute based on the community and donation givings. So from that perspective, on the marketing side, balanced by the science of brewing, it would significantly impact what we are able to contribute to the existing state.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's, Mr. Parker?
Yeah.
Let's bring the mic to you there.
All right.
All right, so I'm sorry. Are there any questions for the Bridgeport team before we go on, Mr. Parker?
Williams. I was just going to declare a potential conflict of interest. I had a Bridgeport Blue Heron earlier this week.
Oh, it was earlier this morning?
Yeah, earlier this morning.
We've got some people in the back of the room we can introduce you to.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Mr. Oakert and Ms. Broder's testimony, and I recognize that this has been, for your industry, somewhat of a moving target, as the numbers have changed and the proposals have changed. But the proposal currently in front of us has a small brewer's exemption. And on the data that I've got in front of me, it indicates that you, based on your gallonage or barrelage production, would not be affected at all by the increase that we're currently considering. So while I appreciate your arguments, if it was a broad-based tax that included no small brewer exemption, both your arguments about impact of price increase and impact on economics and job loss, and yours about community involvement, which I think is a very positive thing for your industry, none of those things would change under this. So I guess, I understand maybe from an industry perspective, one for all for one sort of approach, but on your actual economic impacts, the current proposal is proposed in the -1 amendments to the bill would have no effect on your business.
If I could just respond, we want it to have an effect on us. We want to grow. We've been growing for 20 years now. We've gone from 1,000 barrels to 40,000 barrels, and we hope to get larger. Yeah. And as you approach that next bank of production, not only does the U.S. federal beer tax, excise tax, go up by twice, by 100%, this proposed Oregon beer tax would also go up. So it's sort of a growth penalty. You know, and like in most businesses, we want to grow. We want to increase our size. It's part of a capitalistic way of doing business, and we want to be part of that too. So
sure, well, and would like you to grow. I mean, yeah. there's no question about that.
And also,
but
the way
you're not going to be affected for quite some time. I mean, the growth would have to more than double in your barrelage production before we get to you.
And the economics of the thing is that when you tax at a higher rate a larger brewer, his distributor, which is also our distributor, will try to spread that out. Try to spread that tax increase out because it's an extra cost for him to do business, and he doesn't want to impact one brewery product, one product line that may be his real bread and butter to that extent. So what he'll do is he'll institute a price increase all around the whole portfolio. So even though we're not paying it, our price on the shelf will go up, and that impacts our sales, and that impacts the rest of that whole web, that whole economic web. So there is an impact to us.
All right. Was there somebody else, Representative Barnhart? Did you?
I had one, but it got answered. Thank
it got
you.
Answered. All right. Now, after several false starts, Mr. Barnhart.
All right. Good morning, Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee. My name is Jim Parker. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Brewers Guild. We're a nonprofit trade association representing Oregon's brewers, their suppliers and wholesalers, retailers, and more than 200 enthusiast members that we call snobs, supporters of native Oregon beer, and I might add whose ranks include our present governor, who joined about a year ago. I'm a fourth generation native Oregonian, former brewer, former pub owner, former National Beer Trade Association executive, and also a recovering journalist, having spent 10 years in three different states in a newspaper career. My friends tell me I can't hold a job, but I've actually been in this one for 4 years, and this issue has been part of that job for all 4 years. My real goal today is to try and put this argument in some sort of perspective, because to read most of the papers and to listen to radio and TV, you get the impression that Oregon's greedy brewers are fighting efforts to bring an outdated minimal tax into line with what's happening in the rest of the civilized world. During last weekend's Oregon Brewers Festival that Paula mentioned, that had 80,000 people in Portland's waterfront all spending money at Oregon hotels, Oregon restaurants, I was next to a group that was collecting signatures and messages to you folks that you'll probably be getting on your desk sometime soon. I watched more than 600 beer lovers sign messages and get their pictures taken, expressing their opposition to increasing the beer tax. And I talked to a lot of these people, and I talked to a lot of them that would say, well, they didn't understand, after reading the paper and listening to TV, why brewers weren't willing to pay an extra few cents a beer to help all these things and worthwhile causes we heard about this morning. And my answer was always the same. We are. Carl, Paula, Jamie, who you'll hear from, all four guys you heard from yesterday, not one of us would be opposed to paying a couple cents, a nickel, a dime, a quarter at the tap, at the check stand, in beer taxes. The question is, who is the target of this tax? The way excise tax is, it is not a consumer tax. It's not pennies at the tap, it's dollars at the brew house. Brewers pay their excise tax every month based on the amount of beer in barrels they remove for sale from their breweries. There's a tank, or in some cases several tanks, marked tax determination tanks. Almost all you guys have a brewery somewhere in your district or nearby. Go there, the brewer would be happy to show you. There's where the tax gets paid. It's not at the tap. It's not at the check stand. Now, it's $2.60 a barrel right now to the state, and $9 up to $18, depending on the size of the brewery, to the federal government. Oregon has 71 breweries right now. They range in size from the tiny three-barrel brew house at Philadelphia's in southeast Portland to the two. And I corrected something on my testimony here. Carl corrected me. Kurt Widmer's brew house is 250 barrels, not 150. So each time Chad Gardner, the brewer at Philadelphia's, fires up his brew kettle, it costs them $34.80 in excise tax. That's on top of every other thing else. For the Widmers, that cost is $51.50. That's $5,150. So even a mythical penny a glass tax increase would increase Philadelphia's daily tax bill $10. For the Widmers, who brew up to three brews a day and sometimes more, increase their daily excise tax bill over $2,000. That's a lot of pennies. We aren't talking about a minimal amount. That tax is paid by the brewer before he sells the beer. It's not that he has an extra pot of money to pay this extra tax. He has to pay the beer, then pay the tax, and then hope he can sell enough beer at that higher price to cover the tax that he's already paid. We heard a little bit of math about, you know, going to the grocery store and looking at the prices. And the gentleman was correct. The average price of a bottle of Oregon beer, Oregon brewed craft beer, in the market is about $1.24, $1.25. That's a 7.49 six-pack. The brewer gets about 67 cents of that. The average price of a pint of beer at your local pub is about $3.50. The brewer gets about 66 cents of that. The rest of that, all the rest of that money in there, is markups and margins. It's not greedy profit-taking by wholesalers and retailers. That's how they employ the other tens of thousands of Oregonians in the wholesaling and retailing of beer. That's how all the rest of that web that Carl talks about happens. So as the beer moves from the brewery to the consumer, adding a few pennies here just gets multiplied to when it to where it's a much larger price. And as you heard yesterday, anytime the price goes up a little, your sales do drop. And as Carl pointed out, we've had this discussion among the wholesalers and myself, what would happen if, in the case of an exemption, would you raise the price only on the national brands that are being taxed? And the answer was an emphatic no. There is no way when 90% of their sales, of the distributor sales, is coming from a major national product, they're going to risk the wrath of that person by narrowing the gap between their price and these pesky local brewers. I mean, in the general scheme of things, folks like Carl and Jamie are a little bit pesky to the big guys because they're taking market share, especially here in Oregon. You heard the word yesterday, 10% of all beer brewed here or consumed here is craft beer. It's actually 10% of all beer consumed in Oregon is Oregon-brewed craft beer. The national average is 3.5. That's all craft beer from everywhere in the country. We are so far beyond anyone else in local support of beer that we're considered a model in the country. So the big brewers already are suffering a lower market share here. Anheuser-Busch's national market share is about 49%. In Oregon, it's under 40. So we're already a little bit of a problem. They aren't going to allow their wholesalers to raise their price and keep ours low. Next thing I'd really like to address is the concept of, you know, Oregon missing out on this annual, you know, beer tax increase bingo that seems to be going on, because it's been since 1977. One of the pages I gave you is pulled off of a website, and it has a map of the states, every state, what their current excise tax is. This, and that, our crack arts department at the Oregon Brewers Guild did update it. We have the state excise tax in barrels of, as of 2001, with my nice little scribbled update, and the year of last change in beer tax. So as you can see, since this was printed in 2001 originally, only five states have raised their beer excise tax, and none to the extent that's being proposed here. Alaska had the largest increase. They doubled theirs. The 1085 number had gone up. It was $16 a barrel. Now it's 33. But they follow the federal model, and the first 60,000 barrels are exempt from the higher tax. You look at the other states, and the largest increase was in Utah, and that's about a 35% increase. Nobody is doubling, tripling. It's very hard to tell on here, but there's a little asterisk with New York. Every year since 2001, they've lowered their state beer excise tax. So it's not a case where we are missing out on the boat and not doing what everybody else is doing. The other question is, you know, where were you in 1977? I was a sophomore in high school, and I had a full head of hair. But I like that. How many breweries were there in Oregon in 1977? How many jobs were created by breweries? Well, the answer is one. There was the Blitz Brewery, and now that's a high-priced retail development. That brewery's been yanked out of here by a large national brewery that bought the brands. What we have in its place are 71, and within 2 months there will be two more breweries opening in the state. We've got 71 breweries employing 2,600 people all across the state, not just in one little block in Portland. And one reason, as you heard yesterday, is a fair tax rate, and it's one of the reasons that Oregon is a leader. One other thing I'd like to point out from the map, since 1991, when the federal excise tax was increased, only 14 states have increased their beer excise tax rates. And the other leading beer-producing states of Colorado, Missouri, and Wisconsin haven't raised theirs since 1969, 1976, and 1971. So we aren't some anomaly in the national picture. I also have a chart just for information purposes that shows the cigarette tax rate in all 50 states. I know Paul Romaine yesterday, he always makes the point that states don't tax their local product, and the lowest tobacco taxes are in tobacco-growing states, and that sheet will show you that he wasn't kidding. Finally, I'd like to address the concept of the brewer being responsible for the social costs of alcohol and drug abuse. There have been numerous studies that have shown in the last several years that when consumed in moderation as intended, beer has many health benefits. It does everything from decrease your bad cholesterol and increase your good cholesterol to thinning your blood, which all result in lower risk of heart disease, which, as another chart I threw in here shows, that's the number one killer in Oregon. There are studies at Oregon State University on the benefits of flavonoids in hops as a cancer fighter. As you'll see, that's the number two killer in Oregon. Moderate beer consumption also has benefits as far as reducing heart disease in people with diabetes. That's the number six killer in Oregon. So as you can see, when taken as intended, the way Carl, the way Jamie, the way Kurt Widmer and Gary Fish intend their customers to drink their beer, it has health benefits. Now, are there problems? Yes. I mean, the gentleman that talked earlier and the woman that talked earlier, there isn't a person here that doesn't understand that alcohol abuse is serious and that there needs to be some kind of treatment, and that treatment needs to be paid for. But the problems that cause alcohol abuse and drug abuse aren't industry specific. It isn't caused by people making a legal product that has health benefits when it's consumed properly. So a tax that addresses that shouldn't be industry specific and borne on the shoulders before sale by people that make this product that actually does have health benefits. You know, 90% of the people that consume beer consume it in a responsible manner. Why should they be penalized for the 10% that don't? There are other factors involved in abuse. Ted Ferrioli, Senator Ferrioli, who is on the governor's conference, or governor's committee on alcohol, I was at a meeting that he spoke at, and he made a comment that stuck with me ever since then. He said he has a real problem with taxing illicit substance, as in licit, not illicit, taxing a legal substance like beer to pay for illicit drug abuse. Connecting those dots, I don't see that connection. I think that's a disconnect right there. Perhaps, and not to make light of the serious nature of alcohol and drug abuse, but perhaps if this body wants to look at a way of taxing an industry, pay for the social cost of its product, should listen to Dr. Mel Cohn, the state epidemiologist in Oregon Department of Human Services. In February of this year, he said obesity is the state's top health problem because of its contribution to heart disease and cancer, top two killers. His words, and I've got his press release here, his words echo those of Dr. Richard Sturm of UCLA, who in 2002 said obesity is a bigger health problem than smoking or heavy drinking. I've attached both press releases. So maybe instead of sitting here talking about pennies a drink on a beer tax, we should be talking about pennies a patty on fast food burgers, because that's a big problem too. And if we're going to attack one industry that causes health problems, well, let's look at everyone that does. Thank you.
Will you be there to testify for that bill?
Sure. Okay. Big Macs get hit twice.
Questions for anyone on this panel? That Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just
This is sort of a question and more of a comment, and I understand you object to any increase in this beer tax. A couple of things struck me, though. Yesterday we heard testimony that the exemption piece that is in this particular proposal, which is sort of designed to help our craft beer industry, might be have legal problems. And then I just heard you folks say that you're going to pay it anyway. So I'm asking myself, why are we looking at this exemption with this being issues?
I'll address that because I've dealt with this issue for 4 years. Every time it comes up, the answer is there is no way to protect us because of the Commerce Clause and the earlier cases like the Hawaii case, Bacchus Dias. Any exemption, because of the vibrant nature of Oregon's craft beer, and because we have such a high percentage of the beer sold in the state is locally brewed, that whole idea of intent, which when you say, well, we're framing this exemption and to protect you, I'm sure that Paul Romaine, if he's here or listening somewhere, is going, they're proving the first half of my case. You cannot have the intent of protecting the local industry. And then the other half of the effect of protecting, well, most of the breweries that would be protected by this exemption are Oregon-based businesses. So on that, those two tests, that exemption would fail. The other reason that we, as a guild, and have talked about this as a body, have decided not to support an exemption, although on the face it looks like it would help us. The same people that distribute all the national brands distribute Carl's beer, Jamie's beer. So if they're getting hit with something, with a tax on 90% of their product stream, again, they aren't going to just raise the tax on that 90%. They're going to raise it across their price to the retailer across the board, and they're going to hit price points. And the way I've explained it in meetings with my members is it's kind of like the choice they're giving you, you know, the choice Dirty Harry used to give somebody. Do you want it in the head, a huge tax increase that will kill you instantly, or do you want to get shot in the gut with higher prices in the market and bleed out? There's no way that to implement a tax that won't hurt the local brewers.
Just if I could respond to that, I think the intent, I know we're talking in casual conversation here in committee about local brewers, that's because that's who's in front of us. But in fact, the effect is an exemption based on volume, not on situs or location.
Exactly.
That's really what this is about. So, you know, when we're talking here about you guys, that's because you're in front of us, not because we've directed this exemption at Oregon brewers. As to the second point, do you need a new distribution system?
That's a whole lot of copies, isn't it?
You want to put that one on the record?
No.
Okay.
Won't touch that one.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure we can help you with that.
Oh, I think we could.
The way the laws are now, and
not with this. Yeah, Representative Barnhart.
I think Vicki has another question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, for making that clear, because I had one other point I want to make with this panel, if I could indulge me, and that is your state beer excise tax rate, state by state, is pointed as to where we are in this. But you also mentioned the retail, that you would rather see a retail than an excise tax. I'd like to point out we do not have a retail,
exactly.
And a lot of these states do, along
That's
with
true.
The excise.
I really have two questions. One of them is more of a comment. As I understand, both from your comments and from earlier things we heard, the federal government charges a differential amount of tax based on the number of barrels that a producer produces. Is that correct?
Yes.
And any idea why they do that?
Yep. When they implemented the current, when they raised the excise tax, doubled it in 1991, they created what they called the small brewer differential, and it was to encourage the growth of craft brewing nationwide.
Thank you. So they have the same motivation that we have as we look at this bill. The other question went out of my head. Where did that come to me? Thank you.
All right. I'm looking forward to reading all these comments in the transcript. Representative Hess.
Well, this is just kind of a comment on the last couple of days of this, that I think both sides of this issue have argued for a restructuring of our tax codes, because until we do that, any time we hit an economic bump in the road, we will always be looking at this. We will always be going to beer drinkers and wine drinkers and smokers and accounting gimmicks. And just in my brief tenure, this seems to be like sort of a twice a year occurrence, having these same guys come up here, and the same people, and the same arguments. And but like I say, although nobody testified for it, I mean, I think there's a pretty strong consensus that we're arguing for a different kind of a tax system from the ground up.
I believe that's the only way that you could do the earlier testimony, when the comment was that this is a user fee. It is not a user fee. It's not a user tax. My hackles as a former editor went up this weekend when I saw the chart in the Oregonian mentioning this is a consumption tax. I mean, I would have had the guy that put that chart together in my office in 10 seconds. It's not a consumption tax. And selling it as one is dishonest. And I think that, you know, until we get a point where we can levy the tax at the consumption level, to call it a pennies per glass is wrong.
Senator Barnard.
And that gets to the second question I had that I now remember.
I was trying to help you there.
Thank you. You did. You did help me. I take it that you're telling us that you would support a direct consumption tax, a sales tax, on a glass of beer in the tavern or on a bottle of beer in the grocery store.
Me personally?
Well, your organization.
We haven't taken a poll or a survey. My gut feeling is, if it were applied at the consumption level evenly and it wasn't a drastic increase, I don't think there'd be a lot of opposition, because at that point it would be truly what everyone has said they want to see. They want to see the problem drinkers pay the bulk of the tax. Carl Oakert isn't a problem drinker.
No.
Kurt Widmer isn't a problem drinker. Why should they be paying thousands and millions of dollars more?
And for you, a sales tax solves your distribution problem, too. Okay. Thank you very much. Just looking ahead, committee, we will break at 10:30 and recess until 1:30. We've got bill introduction at that time. We'll try and finish up testimony, too. Anyway, we don't get this morning. Let me take up next Jamie Floyd and... you were sort of the last one in this group, I guess, so we'll bring up another after you. Floyd.
Thank you, Chairman Chatterley, and the rest of the committee for seeing me this morning. For the record, my name is Jamie Floyd, and I am the head brewer for Steelhead Brewery and Cafe in Eugene, Oregon, and also the current president of the Oregon Brewers Guild. I will try to make my comments short in respect to those who also want to speak today. And but first, I do want to apologize for not turning off my phone before entering and for its yelling and screaming nature and its silencing. I don't understand why they make a lot of noise when you try to shut it off, but I apologize to everyone here. I've been up here before as representative of the president of the Oregon Brewers Guild, and I'm actually here today representing the physical brewers of the state of Oregon to maybe help with an idea of what I do for a living and what my place within the economy truly is. I graduated from the University of Oregon in 1994 with a degree in sociology, focus in community studies. I have a deep commitment towards building community resources and looking towards, especially on a city level, ways that we can affect positive change and growth for communities across the United States. Upon graduation, I got involved with the Steelhead Brewery as a night kitchen manager to begin paying off college debt and to place myself back within the working class after a long 12-year study from childhood up through college. I felt like I wanted to get into the roots of things and explore things instead of pursuing PhDs and other things that I can sometimes feel as abstract, not hands-on. I was a home brewer in college. I was inspired by the people that you have seen give testimony in the last few days, Kurt Widmer, Gary Fish, Carl Lockhart, John Harris. Those folks were heroes of mine in sort of a way. They got me to realize the value of a quality beer over the consumption of beer, made me fall in love with the art of brewing. Brewing is an artisan trade that is one of the few maybe left that are passed down from a sort of teacher-student level on a hands-on level. I did not need a college education to get the job that I had, but it has helped me in understanding the world around me. Briefly, I would like to say that I work 40 to 60 hours a week on a salary job. I have benefits, both health and dental. I feel very fortunate to have. I am almost a year upon my one-year anniversary of being married and am in the market right now for buying a home. I have worked very hard over the course of since almost 10 years ago of graduation to pay off all of my college debt. I own a 1987 Nissan pickup truck outright that is extremely beat up but incurs no debt. And my wife and I have been sitting on investment money on a mortgage that will put us extremely in debt, but for something good for us. I hope one day that I will be able to continue the tradition that I've seen and add further to the community of Eugene and Oregon to one day become a proprietor of a brewery and a brewer owner-operator of a brewery in the Eugene area, if possible. I'm very interested in promoting the downtown growth of Eugene, which has struggled over the last 20 or 30 years to discover itself and become viable. And brew pubs throughout the centuries have provided that central force, a place for people to discuss issues over a pint of quality beer and some food, and to talk to each other in a society that is increasingly dependent on computer screens instead of personal interaction. Though many statements have been said about exemptions and such, we are all wary of the litigation that's involved and for the tendency that Representative Haas has said of relooking again and again in the future for revenue in that way. And I hope that we can look in the future for a way to generate revenues that doesn't outlie one specific industry and such. Again, I'm going to make this brief and terminate this, but I wanted to give you an idea. I represent all of the brewers in the state of Oregon, and actually in the United States, of course, who do this job day in and day out. In my weekends, I've spent three or four Saturday, Sundays in the last 3 months at charitable cause events, donating my time and my services to raise money. A number of us, Carl Lockhart and Jim Parker, both were at the Summer Brewers Games out in the coast at the Pelican Brew Pub. And we raised $3,000 on a Saturday for the boosters, the local boosters, children's programs out there. I've been involved with the Eugene Microbrew Festival that celebrated its 11th anniversary. And for its first 10 years, it was supporting the Easter Seals of the organization, have raised well over $100,000 over the course of years for that, and hard work and dedication. My wife will attest to the amount of time that I dedicate outside of normal work towards causes via telephone calls that I try to turn off and such. Now we're proud to be representing KLCC, which is a local radio station that has public broadcasting that has seen major cuts in the last few years. We were able to raise $16,000 last year, just a few months ago, rather, which basically bridged half of the gap that they lost in the last few months from $32,000, I believe, that they lost in their budget cuts. We were able to raise half of that back. Again, I want to reiterate that with prices going up, things have to give. We will try not to lose jobs and increase the unemployment in the state of Oregon, and in that respect, a lot of that energy will have to go into working even more overtime. So the 40 to 60 hours could increase there, and that rare free time won't be dedicated towards the causes that we like. I'm really proud of the state of Oregon's craft brewers in general for the dedication that they have in outside causes. I think that spending a few afternoons with brewers, that you would understand and see the passion and dedication that we have for the state of Oregon and for the community around us and the way that it can work from the ground up, so to speak, on the outside of the workforce and outside of the tax structure. And that's all I really want to say. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Floyd. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say that I appreciate the work that you do. And as a Eugene resident, I have had occasion to participate or partake of the both the brew and the food at the at your brew pub. Would you describe for us briefly what your barrelage is per year, and also what percentage of it you sell retail rather than wholesale?
Yes, we are currently for the last we're on track again this year for being at 1,355 barrels a year. We are a small 10-barrel brew pub. I brew probably 165 batches of beer, or 135 rather batches of beer a year, and we are only able to do one batch of beer a day. So we are on active brewing time one out of every 3 days, including weekends. There's a lot of other work outside of just the actual brew day. As far as on-site versus distributorship, that fluxes greatly depending on the climate. And, of course, our partnership with our distributorship has different waves of good and bad salesmanship as well. So it kind of depends on the climate of things. But I would say that we would probably sell about 60 to 70% of it on-site. And it kind of depends. Again, we have events that go through distributorships that change that drastically depending on whether we're asked to attend or not.
And one more question. I know other brew pubs have different business models, but as president of that association, perhaps you can give us an idea whether these figures are comparable for them as well, or if they're likely to be significantly different than that.
As actually Representative Pafar has mentioned to me before, the brewing industry is one of the most complex business industries. It's very hard, as you've seen with all the testimony here and all the ways that you can look at things, to really assess the way the businesses are run in the state of Oregon. Every single brewery, because of its, for the most part, of the craft brewery or the small brew pub breweries, all have different business plans with different focuses. Some don't do any outside distribution. Some of them are completely dependent upon distribution, depending on their size. Caldera Brewery is probably just under 2,000 barrels a year. They have no brew pub. They are completely distributed product. Whereas there are other places, such as the McMenamin's chain of breweries, who sell almost none of their beer outside of their own establishments at all. So that it really does range and change. I'd say that there are some breweries that are a lot more aggressive than Steelhead for selling off-site and are dependent on that cash flow. Steelhead has been around for since 1991, and as you folks from Eugene know, has had a long-standing reputation and kind of draws more of a restaurant crowd. So we have that kind of stability going for us. So I hope that, does that kind of answer that? It can jump all over the place. Some places are very dependent on their distribution. Some others are able to withstand it a little bit more without that.
Thank you.
All right. We need to recess for the morning. Committee, if I can ask you to be back at 1:30, we'll take more testimony on this bill. We'll finish the testimony on House Bill 3656, and we've got some other testimony perhaps on 2182 and bill introduction. So back at 1:30, we are in recess. Betty, welcome everybody here for our afternoon session. We've got several things we're going to be doing, many of them at the same time. This is going to be amazing to watch.
Always amazing to watch.
Start with a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 2837 from this morning. And as soon as we get a fifth member to establish a quorum, we will interrupt that hearing to go to LC to introduction of LC 3743. And we also need work this afternoon on House Bill 2182 and 3656. So With that, let's go. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2837. And call up where we left off this morning. Gordon Foltz and Gina Furman? Nope. Gordon, there you are. Okay, there you're both here.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz with the Association of Oregon Counties. I was here in 1975, 1977, so I want to paint a picture for you what we were doing at the time, at least from my perspective. We were in the old building, committee just like this, probably more in the middle of the session, of a normal session.
This could be.
Interesting at the time, it was smoke-filled rooms, because smoking was allowed, both at your level as well as down in our level, interesting enough. There was great concern among members about the prevalence of alcohol and drug problems throughout the social service, human service, as well as the correction system. And because of that, they were trying to find ways to devote additional resources to that problem. They looked at the hard liquor receipts, recognized they were part of the general fund of the state and counties and cities, where already there were expenditures for public safety, corrections, and human services being made. But they looked at beer and wine as a place where there were no taxes dedicated for this purpose. And they passed, during that session, 1975, the original bill putting a tax and dedicating the tax to alcohol and drug, House Bill 2145. They also recognized at that time the fledgling wine industry that was occurring in Oregon and other places, and recognized and put an exemption in, exemption similar to what's being proposed in the amendments that you have before you today. They came back in 1977 to this particular wing, new wings at the time, and that committee said, hey, it's been 2 years, we already have inflation that's occurred, and they adjusted the tax upward. That was 26 years ago. We have not had an adjustment since. I think, Mr. Chairman, that the nexus between the problems that are created with the use and misuse of alcohol and drug was created by that legislature on beer and wine. The decision before you today is whether or not you want to continue that nexus. We would suggest yes. The second decision is whether or not the rate of the tax is sufficient in today's market. We would say no, and that it ought to be increased. And so that's where we're coming from. Counties, as they are today, at that time, were basically providers of service, of human services and public safety services for the state. We've been doing that for a lot of years, and we do it at your direction. We are just basically the providers of those services, and they have local elected officials accountable for the results. That's the key ingredient. It's different from any other provider of service. We are responsible for the results. Our constituency is the same as yours. We are as much concerned as counties about the vitality of business as you are. We are as much concerned about the constituents as you are. We are concerned that there be some kind of balance between those two. And that's kind of where we come. We were there as a proponent in 1975, again in 1977, and we have been on every campaign since that time to suggest an adjustment in this tax in order to better represent the needs that are out there, not disproportionate, but just proportionate, so that we can address the problems. There will always be more problems than we have resources for, particularly with alcohol and drug and mental health, unfortunately. But some minimal level is needed, and so that's what we're striving for. We did a study, just quickly, and I think your staff's already gone through this, but 50% of the current tax goes dedicated to the mental health account for alcohol and drug and mental health treatment. That 50% is divided 40% directly to counties, which can be matched by the state's 40%. It gets 40% as well if there's an agreed-upon plan. 20% of those resources of that 50% go for correction services in the correctional institutions. The other 50% goes into the what I call the hard liquor fund, joins that, which is 56% to the state, 34% to the cities, and 10% to the counties. We did a study back in the 70s to say how much do counties expend with regard to alcohol and drug problems, not just the typical problems you can think of in the public safety system and the human services system, but problems, interestingly enough, like replacing signs that have been hit by drivers under the influence, other kinds of things that were throughout the system. And our conclusion at that time was that what we received as counties, 10%, the cost to counties was four times that amount at that particular time, the 70s. Now, it's been 20-some-odd years since then, but we would probably allege that there's certainly more cost today. There's more prevalence today of problems than there were at that particular time. Today, that 50% that goes into the treatment side of the equation represents $5 million a year to counties, directly to counties. $5 million is matchable to the state. And then $2 million for, that's approximate, for the corrections facilities. All of that is controlled by DHS. Basically, they have the responsibility for making sure that we expend those monies properly. And I think they have done so. Certainly, we're under audit control as well. So we feel that we've been expending those resources, what little they are, very responsibly. There's little county money that goes into A&D. There used to be more, but with budget shortfalls at our level, we've had a problem putting money in there. So most of the resource is coming from the state and some federal level. We have the first piece of information you have is an information packet. It's the one that has my testimony in front of it. It was addressed to House Bill 2804, which was a previous bill you had on this topic, using the same formula, I might add, as you've got in these particular amendments. In that packet, there's some interesting information and facts that the Department of Human Services put forth on the prevalence of alcohol and drug use and problems. There's also the history of liquor control originating with counties, done by Ken Tolinar, who's the former director of the Bureau of Governmental Research and Service at the University of Oregon. And it's just an interesting piece of information about the history of liquor control in the state of Oregon. And you'll see that where we had the control originally, like we have some other things, and in lieu of a cut of the resources, we basically provided the state with the authority. I've also attached a copy of a packet which we used at the press conference you heard referred to earlier today, the press conference of those sponsors, legislative sponsors of beer and wine tax increased legislation. And the press packet has some very convincing, I believe, information in it regarding where we are, comparison to other states. You've heard about that, what some of the problems are. Basically, I won't go through all of that detail, but it is with that packet you should take a look at. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to discuss those. And then a further study that's attached in that packet, that second packet, that's a recent, within the last 2 months, study that we did on what the status of the A&D and mental health system is statewide. We surveyed all of the counties and all of the private nonprofit systems. We concluded that after five special or six special sessions, emergency board actions, rebalances, that we were in sad shape. No crisis services. And that package explains what we felt was the condition after having the survey. Secondly, what we felt was a minimal Band-Aid package to repair that system. And probably most importantly is where the details are in the 1,800 job losses that you've heard about a couple of times. County-by-county losses are noted in that report that we did in that survey. 1,800 jobs in the public health, mental health, and alcohol and drug system have been lost during this last year and a half period. Significant numbers of folks, and more importantly, is not necessarily, well, I want to say important, certainly the FTE losses, but as important is the fact that 85 to 90% of those folks were clinicians, actual people seeing clients. And each one of those, we estimate, probably saw approximately 70 people per month. That capacity has been lost. Other anecdotal information is attached in that report on each county as they anticipate what might happen whenever the session ends. And so you can read about your own counties there. We certainly do believe that there's a social cost. There's been certainly a nexus created between gambling and gambling addiction treatment. 1% of the lottery proceeds dedicated to gambling addiction treatment, between cigarette use problems, and it's paid for by cigarette tobacco settlements, the health plan, and other places. We also believe that there's high liquor expenditures in social services, and there ought to be a continuation of the nexus between beer and wine and those problems. We also have polling data in that second. You heard polling data referred to today. The actual polls are referred to in that second packet that I gave you. There's been about four of them, and they're all noted there. In looking back 26 years, reflecting what has happened, and looking at today's cost and needs, we strongly believe that you need to adjust this particular tax. There has been no adjustment all of that time. That year, particularly, was the year that the Capitol Wings were done, was the year that the Blazers won the NBA championship, was the year that Star Wars was first put out, and it was sadly the year that Elvis Presley died. We think an adjustment is due. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Gordon. Gina?
Hi. Chair Shetterly, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I represent 31 of the 32 community mental health programs. As you know, in the last 17 months, we have laid off over 1,800 mental health and addiction workers in all 36 counties due to budget cuts. Those are family wage jobs. You heard family wage jobs talked about. That means over 50,000 people that have been receiving mental health and addiction services are not receiving them, or they are finding other ways to receive these services, such as more expensive hospital visits and public safety system stays. We have been operating since February 1st with zero crisis dollars. Yes, zero crisis dollars since February 1st. Many counties are draining their operating reserve or discontinuing services and transferring money into the crisis line. Some counties no longer have crisis services. We're not going to be able to continue that much longer. So I think we need to have a philosophical look at what we do with our most needy Oregonians that have mental health addiction issues. All the non-Medicaid adult mental health treatment money has been cut. All supported employment and housing general fund money has been cut. And alcohol and drug treatment money has been eliminated for almost 50% of our most needy Oregonians. You asked us not to come to you with a problem unless we could come to you with a solution also. You contract with the counties to provide mental health and addiction services for Oregonians that have little or no health insurance or simply cannot afford these services. I want to thank Representative Williams and the other representatives and senators that have taken a look at a beer tax, and I want to thank Representative Williams for bringing this particular solution to you. I think a beer tax is at least a part of the solution that's tied to the problem. I mean, that there is a nexus there. We're asking you to support this bill, and please, please don't let another 26 years go by without taking a look at this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure we'll be done before then. You're not? Questions for either of these? If not, thank you very much. Let me recess the hearing on House Bill 2037 for a moment here to take up the LC draft that you have before you, committee. Well, we have a quorum moving on this. This is LC 3743. It is the implementing bill to HJR 18. It also authorizes the issuance of COPs for pension bond refinancing, pension liability refinancing, if the general obligation bonds under HJR 18 are not approved. So this is the bill that comes under HJR 18. Chair would move introduction of LC 3743 as a committee bill, of course, without any commitment by any member of this committee to support the measure once it gets to the floor. But is there any discussion on that motion or any objection? Hearing none, LC 3743 is entered as a committee bill. Okay, thank you. Let's reopen the hearing on House Bill 2837. Ellen Lowe, Ellen, did I see you come in? There you are. And Angela Kimball, why don't you come forward?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I come before you today because of some things I heard yesterday about some of the intent of allocations to cities and counties that occurred in 1977. And I should explain my background regarding this issue. In 1977, I was president of the League of Oregon Cities. And so in that capacity, I was here practically every day from the first day of the session until after midnight, so it was early the morning of July 5th, on behalf of what we call general revenue sharing for cities. We started working on that after the 1975 legislative session, in which the leaders of the league, the elected officials from across the state, along with the staff, began having meetings all across Oregon. And some of you will recall, a few of you will recall, that at that time, cities were beginning to deal with the expectations that were being placed on them to be the logical providers of urban services within urban growth boundaries. And the need was very different in different cities across the state, sometimes because of geography, sometimes because of size. And so we spent all of 1976 working on putting together a strategy that would provide some shared revenues from the state to cities to meet their obligations for these expectations. And so we came to the legislature with the support of the governor, the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, the chairs of the substantive committees, with a proposal to receive a share of the state income tax that would then be the basis for general revenue sharing for cities. We were met the first day of the session with a message from the chair of the then House Revenue Committee that revenue sharing for cities was dead as a doornail. And so we went back out to the communities, and we had folks here at the session through all of that month, all of that year, from January to through July. And actually, it wasn't until the last week of the session that the proposal for receiving a share of the state income tax was looked at by some of the leaders in this building, and a change occurred. And that was, I recall, when Steve Bauer was then the executive director of the League of Oregon Cities, and I were asked to come and meet with Jason Bowe, the president of the Senate, and Jack Ripper, who was co-chair of Ways and Means, and we met around that octagonal table up in that office. And we discussed that maybe there was another way to receive funds that would respond to growth in Oregon, as we had anticipated the income tax would. And that would be to go to a share, and it was 14% of the markup, the revenues that were coming to the state of Oregon from our retailing of distilled spirits. And so rather than leaving this session with share of income tax. We left with a share of those revenues that were coming to the OLCC from the distilled spirits. But what I really want to stress, and that was why I responded to the invitation to come before you today, is that never during any of those discussions was there any association of the need for those funds with the source of the funds. And so it was general purpose, and essentially what we were doing was, you might call it a sleight of hand, but those dollars had been put into general fund, but instead they were allocated to cities. I should also say that as president of the league, during that period of time, and I had been on the executive committee for 4 years prior, we also worked with the other one of the other occupants of the local government center, and that was the Association of Oregon Counties, in putting together the proposal, which was directly related to the cost to local government as a result of the use and abuse of alcohol. And so the beer and wine tax had the participation of cities. And when we, the allocation that went to cities, we were part of looking at the need. And what we did in 1977 was really, again, with surveys all across the state. I believe there were 181 cities going from Greenhorn and the Wallowas to the city of Portland in size. We looked at really what the costs were. And so what was allocated in 77, unlike the general revenue sharing, which was to be a continuing contribution that could respond to growth and need, what we asked for in the other part, along with our counties, brethren, was really to look at actual costs in 1977. As I look back, it never occurred to any of us that this many years later we would still be looking at the same amount, because it has not experienced the same degree of growth that we were able to achieve in general revenue sharing. But again, the purpose of those dollars, it was for a general purpose government, for general purposes that would allow them, again, to be the logical provider of urban services, as they were asked to do. We didn't use the word mandate in those days. We talked about expectations, and we hoped that those dollars would allow us to meet those that were being presented to us by the state. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Looks like we're okay. Thank you for the background on that, Ellen.
Thanks.
Ms. Kimball?
Chair Federley and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Oregon. And in contrast to previous testimony, I'm here to represent the thousands and thousands of Oregonians who would actually benefit from such a tax and its distribution to counties for drug and alcohol treatment, co-occurring disorders, mental health treatment, and public safety programs. And I'd just like to say that to our membership, this bill embodies the rather sensible notion of spending an alcohol tax on programs that are related to the possible ill effects of alcohol. Our gas taxes go to a fund for highways, and a percentage of our lottery proceeds go to a gambling addiction treatment. Why not then dedicate alcohol taxes to fund programs to treat those who are addicted and those who are at high risk for addiction, such as the mentally ill? We know that you've heard from many people who would like to maintain the status quo, and you've heard from many people who have said that our beer taxes are extraordinarily low. I won't bother to repeat those, but I would like to point out that the beer industry and wine industry nationwide spends over $1 billion a year in print advertising, TV ads, radio ads, and at least $2 billion more a year on sponsorships, retail displays, and other promotional items. So their claims of economic hardship and the imminent layoffs seem a bit disingenuous to me. And I'd like you to also think about the public. They continue to wonder what their taxes are paying for. And this is, quite frankly, a very simple way of showing that your taxes are going for something that benefits the community. People understand that, and they benefit from it. Community mental health, alcohol and drug, and public safety programs hire real people in your local communities. As Gina Furman indicated, over 1,800 individuals with paying jobs have been cut from community economies. It's time to restore those. And beyond that, those employees not only contribute to the local economy, they help people with problems. And those people, their illnesses without help, will cost the community much, much more in increased medical claims, disability, injuries, decreased productivity, and criminal justice involvement. Not to mention the cost to the taxpayer of child welfare involvement when parents do not get the treatment they need. The Sunday Oregonian article that you have a copy of is entitled Diminished Care and Diminishing Returns, and it illustrates that problem very well. It noted that the perceived savings of reducing mental health and addiction services from the Oregon Health Plan are already evaporating as we fill our emergency rooms and our hospitals with people requiring more expensive emergency care. And due to budget cuts, over 100,000 Oregonians no longer have access to mental health or chemical dependency treatment. And there are no dollars in the current budget for outpatient alcohol and drug treatment. There's no budget for non-Medicaid community mental health services. And as you've heard, there's no funding for crisis services right now. The counties are operating on reserves. These treatment services are going away. And the need for funding couldn't be clearer. And beyond that, the prospects for actually funding effective and efficient treatment programs couldn't be better. The president just came out with this new Freedom Report on mental health care. And it specifically called for using consistently evidence-based best practices. And Representative Williams is intimately familiar with that through his work on Senate Bill 267, which demands that our alcohol and drug treatment programs and our mental health treatment programs dedicate a percentage of their funds to evidence-based best practices. We are very well poised to make the very transformation of our system that our president has asked for. But this bill, with its amendments, are the way to help make that a reality. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Berger?
Angela, thank you so much for being here today. I can certainly understand why people are very concerned about how we're going to finance the needs of people in human services all across the board. One thing I'd like to point out, and you may correct me if I'm wrong, in your testimony about the national expenditure of the $1 billion in TV ads and so forth, that might not connect with our Oregon breweries. Were those national, or does this refer to people here in Oregon?
It refers nationally. So that would include everyone, including Oregon breweries to national.
Right, right. They have to probably participate in some of that, but they certainly probably couldn't afford anything like that kind of advertising. And I don't think their claims of economic hardship are intended to be disingenuous. I have to defend them a little bit here. But I do appreciate your testimony, and I believe that regardless of whether we have a beer tax or whether we don't, I think we need to address the needs of people that have this kind of need in our state. So thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Kibble. All right, I have three more folks. Let's finish up the testimony on this bill with these three, and I know you didn't sign up together, but let's go ahead and fill the chairs. Mary Ann Schwab, Barry Fenimore or somebody from Oregon Partnership, and Steve Harris. Okay, 2 out of 3. Okay, Mr. Harris, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lee, and the members. This is my first time I've ever testified, so I'm a little nervous.
All right.
And I don't represent anyone except for the people that don't have representation. I was born in Emanuel Hospital in 1957. I went to Beaverton High School, where I dropped out in my junior year. I used drugs and alcohol extensively. I finally got my GED sometime later. I've been sober now for over 13 years, and a few years ago I decided to that I wanted to be a drug and alcohol counselor. And I'm in my internship right now, which I've gone through Portland Community College, and I'm down here working with an agency that's also involved in the Marion County Drug Court. And I work with Judge Graves, going in and this part of the staffing, and I've done volunteer work at the Paul Treatment Center. I'm aware of the cuts at places like Cascadia and Multnomah County, and I'm here because those people that these funds go to don't have representation. They don't have people flown in. I put my money in the meter to be here today. And after listening to the story on OPB this morning and reading the Statesman Journal and the Oregonian, it compelled me to be here today. I've been here in previous days. I brought the letter to many of you from Mayor Drake of Beaverton, talking about his wanting to see this pass and funds for alcohol and drug treatment. All the numbers have been brought up. I can't represent that. But when I see articles like Mr. Widmer presented yesterday saying he's concerned about whether or not to hire 6 temporary employees, and I think about the many, many people in my years that I've seen die because of drugs and alcohol, to think of a few pennies on a bottle of beer and have this be a question and have representatives of the industry talk about thwarting the entire tax system in Oregon it really concerns me. And I'm in Representative Hass's district, and also Senator Deckard's. You know, I live in a neighborhood of $300,000 plus houses. I'm successful in what I've done, and I can tell you lots and lots of successes from people going to treatment and where this money goes. And I can also say that most people don't ever see what it looks like in the people that are in DePaul Treatment Center. And DePaul has to say, you know, we're going to cut out 6 beds or whatever it might be, or Cascadia has to lay off half of their staff. And I really urge that this get through this committee and stay in one form or another to the maximum amount that can go to treatment and the other services that this money provides. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I really appreciate your time and being here.
Well, thank you for coming down today. Are there questions, Representative Verger?
I just want to say to you that you are what we all are all about and talking about. If we can just clone you over and over and over again, and you've come from making some poor decisions to making some very good ones, and are here today to talk about that. And so you need not be nervous. You have a wonderful success story, and I just wish that many others could tell your story. I wonder if you might just very briefly, because I know we have a lot of people, is there anything that you think in your success that made the difference? Was it the length of time? Was it 90 days of treatment as opposed to 30, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Well, I really believe that if somebody is assessed and needs inpatient treatment, because there's different levels of treatment, There's inpatient, there's outpatient, there's intensive outpatient, and then there's education for people that are diagnosed with more abusing rather than dependent upon alcohol. And for those that are assessed properly, the longer the treatment, obviously the better. We're talking about learning new ways of life. One of the things that I helped with at DePaul was put together was a Christmas party or a holiday party, because most of these, the men there, didn't know how to have a party. And so the longer the treatment's available for them, they learn and educate, get educated about how to live life. And that's what's happened so often when people that really need to be there longer aren't there, is they get back out and they really didn't get enough chance. This 7-day treatment or spin, it does nothing, particularly for someone who is addicted. And maybe sometimes it does take people 2 or 3 times to go through. That's not a failure if that person maybe drinks or uses a couple of times in a 1 or 2 year period. They've been sober most of that time, and that's good. And they've learned, and maybe one of these days they're going to walk out of there and get sober. I was lucky. I drank one time since I went to treatment in 1988. And
Thank you. All right. Thanks again for coming in. Appreciate your testimony today. Ms. Schwab, welcome back.
Thank you, Representative Sibley and the committee. I'm here to root for our new beer tax. A little visual, a little shoveling up here. It's time that we kind of come to the final cost. This represents 0.75 since 1977. And for clarification, that pay raise or that hike at that time was 0.375. So that's the figure we had back in 1977. I hope today I had been rooting for a dime, and I've learned my dime was worth 7 cents, and then I heard rumors only worth 2 cents. And I said, well, if that's the case, I said, oh, it's never going to get out of committee. We have some real arm twisters around here, because someone is able to get this out of the big budget into a little one. Well, I'm here to twist some arms myself.
Ms. Phillip, if I could ask you to bring your bucket down. We've got the camera taking a picture. We know they're going to get us a bucket. So
that's fine. It makes my point.
A talking bucket.
Yeah, we're talking bucket.
You can do better.
If we raise this thing to 7 cents, we're up to over $100 million. We need this money. You've heard the agencies that are in the treatment recovery, the prevention people with teenagers. I'm a retired secretary. I could really tell you what happens to alcohol in teenagers. But I'm not going to re-go through that history today. I think you know that. I'm not going to insult your intelligence. To introduce myself, my name is Marianne Schwab. I'm a member of a grassroots citizens group that has been in strong support of increasing Oregon's beer excise tax. I thank this committee for accepting public testimony on the important question of raising additional revenue through an increase of the state's beer tax. The beer tax is in serious need of adjustments. As the committee knows, the state has one of the nation's lowest taxes on beer. Approving an increase would bring Oregon more in line with similar taxes implemented by our neighboring states, would help reduce health care costs associated with alcohol use and abuse, and would improve public safety and lessen human toil associated with alcohol abuse. Alcohol consumption is strongly associated with several of the most costly public health issues facing Oregonians today, including alcohol-related injuries, disease, and fatalities, fetal alcohol syndrome, domestic violence, vehicle crashes. Criminal activity is also strongly associated with alcohol consumption, contributing heavily to the cost of police services, the criminal justice system, and the jail, prison, and probation systems. As a retired secretary who has worked in the public schools for years, I am especially concerned about the impact of the alcohol consumption on youth. Comprehension research spanning 2 decades shows that alcohol use during adolescent years is associated with damage to memory and learning capabilities, as well as to the decision-making and reasoning areas of the brain. Recent national surveys find high rates of binge drinking among high school and college students and college-age young adults, with increasing. over the past 10 years in frequency of drinking, drunkenness, drinking to get drunk, and alcohol-related problems. Because of this, the American Medical Association and the Oregon Medical Association have strongly endorsed increasing a tax by 17 cents per 12-ounce drink. I have letters of attachment in support of this as well. You have that in your packet. Applying beer tax revenue and substance abuse to mental health services would help our financially strapped human services system provide desperately needed services for substance abuse and addiction. The tax increase in itself would help reduce the cost of services by reducing consumption by a small margin. The fact is, beer is the alcohol of choice for Oregonians, including youth. The beer industry spends hundreds of millions in marketing dollars actually to encourage consumption. However, the revenue from this consumption provides only a scant funds to help pay for the resulting costs. We know that there is a huge disparity between what the state of Oregon pays out in costs associated with substance abuse and alcohol abuse makes up a large share of that. According to the study published by the National Center of Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University, the state of Oregon spends almost $1 million alone on costs related to substance abuse. The beer tax, as currently structured, makes only a modest contribution to that total amount. The tobacco industry has long since decided that it is responsible for a significant portion of health care costs and that its products creates. It is not unreasonable to suggest that the beer industry likewise pay a modest amount more to help defray the expenses incurred by the use of its products. Otherwise, Oregon taxpayers will be forced to continue subsidizing this industry for the costs associated with its products. A beer increase is a user fee, a damage deposit, that several recent surveys show that a majority of Oregonians support if the revenue is dedicated to specific services that reduce social, economic, and human costs of alcohol. Again, that's prevention, treatment, recovery, and law enforcement. I urge you to respond to the will of the majority of Oregonians and ensure that a beer tax increase legislation gets full and fair consideration this legislative session. Thank you for the opportunity to address this committee, and I will answer any questions if I can.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Schwab? I think you were down last time we had the hearings on the beer tax, weren't you?
I'm fine for a dime.
That's right, I remember that.
And I guarantee.
And now you're here for a beer.
Now I'm here, you bet. Hey, I've been to Austria, and when you talk about beer, we don't hold a candle to it. My concern is that the article this morning in the paper about the unfairness of the product tax, it says that it'll damage the bright spot in Oregon's economy. It won't. The bright spot is for all those petitioners on the street getting paid minimum wage to collect signatures. And I'm ready to get another job.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Schwab. All right. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2837. And let me go to reopen our public hearing on House Bill 3656. Roger Martin. We're all ears. They'll be back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I approach this with full understanding. I think Ellen Lowe gave a wonderful historical perspective. She reminded me the last day I served on your side of the table, which was that July 5th, 1977. I approach this with a sinking heart. I'm looking at the two of you left here. I understand the motivation for Senate Bill, House Bill 3656 is well illustrated. If you've got the sheet there, but I think the committee did at one time, on the results, and I think everybody is fixated down in the right-hand corner, $21, $20, or $22 million raised by this. I'd like for a moment to, first of all, I want Senator Walker to be correct. I'm not going to talk about anything that she was mentioning because that's not what my objection to the bill is. So the refuting she did, it doesn't concern what I'm talking about. Section 2, and if I could just get an opportunity for you to look at the bill itself. This is a combination of several fees, and licenses, and you need to know that. Section 2 of the bill covers the issue of new securities in Oregon. I don't have any problem with that. We should be charging, and especially since the agency itself is in charge of coverage of that review and so forth. Section 4 of the bill has to do with license fees. I think both those sections were very accurately described by the division director himself. I would only point out to you the one part on page 5 that has to do with license fees are lines 8 and 9. Lines 8 and 9 cover federally licensed investment advisors who do not have any, which the state of Oregon doesn't have any authority over. And that their present fee is $100. It will rise to something. I should start by telling you that I represent the Investment Company Institute. I do not represent the Security Industry Association. I did at one time in years past. You should know, because Senator Walker mentioned I had no position on the bill, the Security Industry Association has become almost totally a federal directed organization, and they do not have any representation in Oregon. They don't even have an association anymore. So your friendly stockbrokers are not going to be real happy, perhaps, and I don't care. I don't represent them. That's their deal. The federally covered investment advisors, again, this is a fee they pay, but for the most part, they're controlled by the federal government. Their different, the differentiation is that they do more than $225 million worth of business per year. The state covers those investment advisors that do less than that. If you look at the somewhere in the front page of the of this law, and as you all understand, ORS is, they start someplace. There's a reference to the Security Act of 1933. And it doesn't take much of to remember why they had a Security Act following the 1929 disaster in the stock market and the horrible depression. That was the dominant security measure for the next 50 years. In 1996, and this has not been mentioned anywhere, in 1996, the National Securities Market Improvement Act was passed in recognition of a vastly different investment community from stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and so forth. It did several things, and this is what I want to really talk about, because the Investment Company Institute is made up of some 7,000 investment companies that are known to us as mutual funds. And just, I don't want to give you a whole economics lesson because I'm not one to do it, but the back of the financial page lists mutual funds, and there are a whole list of them here. There's a small amount up at the top that are Northwest firms, and there are about four or five listed there that are actually Oregon mutual funds. Oregon historically has had very few mutual funds. Columbia Investment in Portland, the Liberty Crab Houston Fund, the Willamette Funds are the ones that are listed here. The vast majority of these funds are headquartered in New York or some other place. The fees that we're talking about, the averaging out, the midpoint that this bill is framed around, that midpoint is based on fees that were charged prior to 1996. Because in 1996, the federal government said, you know, states, you have no longer any jurisdiction over mutual funds. Those will be controlled by the federal government, except for prosecution of pure fraud, which can be done in, outside of the agency. The agency receives filing fees. That was decided. The states came to the federal government and said, look, if you're going to take away all our authority, you're vastly affecting the structure we have to build our securities divisions. So the federal government said, we will allow you to charge a filing fee, which is simply every mutual fund that does business in Oregon files with the department and pays here, in this case, $350. In other states, they play a whole different scheme. Washington charges $200, California $100, plus a percentage of what each fee does, because you need to understand something. This would be like saying every automobile company that sells a car in Oregon will pay X thousands of dollars, whether it's Ford Motor Company or the company that makes six little whatevers. It's a very uneven tax if you just go across the board and say the national level is X. Now, subsequent to 1996, a number of states, Florida, for instance, Georgia, some others, dropped all filing fees because they simply said, look, if we have no jurisdiction over mutual funds, we shouldn't be charging a fee. Now, I will look at you and tell you that Section 4 of the bill is a license fee. And it's a license fee, and Senator Walker described it. In fact, she said otherwise. It seems ridiculous to her that plumbers have to pay $100 in Oregon. Stockbrokers only have to pay $15. I won't argue with that. Section 1 of the bill is a consumer tax. It is not a tax on business. And just please understand that. Mutual fund fees, the management fee, and any other expenses are paid by the individual who owns a mutual fund. And what you're about to do, and I understand the impetus behind this because it's on everybody's list to go home, pass this bill, it's $20 million, we can balance the budget and go home. What you're doing is passing the largest consumer fee of anything I know of in this session. You're going to almost quadruple the fees paid. And the application is totally uneven. If you own Fidelity, one of the Fidelity funds, which are the largest in Oregon, spread out the $1,250 over that, and individuals will pay very little. If you own one of the smaller or a new fund, if somebody wants to start a new fund, initially the investors in that are going to invest a very large amount. Now, I got to tell you, you've gotten the national attention by the idea that we're going to go simply to a median. We're going to ask the director to search the country and come up with what the middle fund is, which apparently, according to this piece of paper, the estimates is $1,250. That's a high level. And it really is an unfair level when you direct it at some of the smaller mutual funds. Crabb Houston may be about to come out with a new fund. You're really going to tax the socks off then, and they don't pay it. I know that everybody thinks these are rich people. They can easily afford. I talked to one of your committee members who's not here right now and said, well, you ought to see some of the other bills we got down here that poor people have to pay. So this one, at least, the people that buy mutual funds can afford it. You should know that nationally, the average age of a mutual fund owner is 47 years, and the average household income is $60,000. Mutual funds are bought by people like me who don't have the time or the ability to go into the stock market and pick out a fund or a stock. You're not taxing any stocks in this. You're taxing the mutual funds. Mutual funds were invented for those of us who want to put some money aside in our retirement funds, in union trust funds, the state's retirement fund. And I hope you clearly understand that this is a consumer tax. It won't be paid by the mutual funds. It's going to be paid by the people that own it. It's going to be paid by Oregonians, and it's a very sizable increase. I can read these figures. I can read the $10 million that you think you're going to get from it. If I had the time, I would bring the experts in who are studying this back east and say what the result of this is going to be: selected filings in Oregon. Smaller funds aren't going to file in Oregon. The large ones, you're not going to chase them out of here. They do too much business. The smaller ones will be discretionary about it. But I also hear the bell ringing for let's go home. And I hope, Mr. Chairman, if nothing else, you would consider the idea of putting a sunset clause. I have been around here long enough to know that Oregon will come out of the recession that's driving you to consider all these various things you're talking about. But at least if you're going to do this, put a sunset on it so it doesn't last forever, because it's going to become like the Liquor Commission, which is here because we get $90 million or more biennium audit. It'll never go away. And I don't think it's the kind of thing in normal times you would be considering. This bill, which was Senate Bill 626, was dead in the Senate committee until the Senate co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee came to the committee and asked them to send the bill down. At the time, they thought it was also had to do with relating clauses to the Ways and Means Committee. So that's how the background. Had it been ordinarily, I don't think the bill would have ever come out of the committee in the Senate. I appreciate the opportunity to talk. I wish the rest of the committee were here to hear it.
Roger, your mention of the sunset, is that directed to a particular section or sections?
Well, I would, because I don't want to have any debate with the department. I have no problem with the license fee part of it, although I would suggest to you that the federal investment advisors are already licensed at a higher level, but especially at Section 1, which deals with mutual funds.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Anybody any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Also, Peter Threlkell, come on forward. You're going to tell us about your online poll, is that it?
Oh, you heard about that.
Surprising results that people don't want to raise their fees.
Well, for the record.
Shocked.
Yeah, shocking. For the record, my name is Peter Threlkell. I'm the director of the Corporation Division here to represent the Secretary of State's office. And first off, we don't have a formal position on the bill. So we're neutral. We do have some concerns. And one of those is what our customers have told us. We first discovered that this concept was moving forward last Wednesday, and we strive to listen to what our customers have to tell us and try and make decisions based on what works for them. So we thought, well, let's just ask them. And we had a little over 1,200 responses in 4 days, while that's not a lot compared to the 300,000 registered businesses that we have, we thought it was a pretty pretty good response for a short period of time. What they told us that, and when we break it down, and not surprisingly, those that would pay the increased fee really don't like the idea. Those that and I'm sure you've heard that.
Well,
before.
We can't do it then.
So we didn't learn anything new there. But those that even those that wouldn't pay the fee, they were a little more warm to it. But there is still considerable opposition. The thing that we did learn was that we asked if this would impact their decision to renew the next time, their next anniversary date. And what we found was surprising, that 42% overall would consider not renewing. Even more striking is with our assumed business names, 46% of them would consider not renewing. And the thing that's important to note about assumed business names is that if you're in business and you're willing to operate your business under your own legal name, you don't need an assumed business name. So, and for assumed business names, that is half of all the registered businesses that we have within the Corporation Division. So I don't know how many of them would actually go through with that. It may be somewhat reactionary to just hearing that that fees are going to double. I guess only time will tell how that plays out. But that is a concern for us, and that was what our customers have to say.
And the assumed business name fee, is that $20 now going to $50? Is that it?
Chairman Shetterly, it's $20 for 2 years,
right.
And the proposal would be $20 or $50 for that same two-year
right.
period.
That's what I mean, yeah. Okay.
The other concerns that we had primarily had to do, these are internal to the division, and the language that's currently in the bill, looking at Section 7, the language in subsection 3 and 5, basically that sets up a brand new accounting procedure for us. Right now, like most agencies, we budget and account for our revenue and expenses at the division level. This would set aside our business registry program and require that we set up a separate budget system for that. So we see that as a bit of an added expense, an additional burden. And
let me just ask if I can interrupt you on that. Setting up a separate account, I see that as the treasurer setting up a separate account. Do you see that as you setting up a separate account? It says here that you'll pay over these fees to the state treasurer, and then it says and deposit at least monthly in a separate sub-account of the operating account. Is it your operating account, or is that an account under the control of the treasurer?
Chairman Shetterly, the account would be at the treasury. We would set it up. We believe there's a fee that they charge us. Okay. That would probably be fairly nominal. But the real expense and burden there is that on a monthly basis, we're having to account for our salaries to that account, our any S&S expenses, anything that we're doing, as well as balancing. So we would have an extra cash account that we had to balance for our business support people. The other problem that we see with that is that our other programs, in a single budget, all the revenue comes into our operating account, and then we pay our division expenses out of that. Right now, the $20 fee for business registry provides a little bit extra money than what's needed for just the business registry side. And we get to that by looking at where we use our FTE, our staff, and doing a prorated calculation based on what we get in revenue and what we spend on any given month. Our other programs, the Uniform Commercial Code filings and Notary Public commissions, come in considerably less than what we're actually having to expend to operate those programs at their current levels. So by setting up the sub-account, we see that would put both of those programs at risk because we would not be able to operate them at the level that we're doing today. Uniform Commercial Code, we have statutory requirements to turn documents around in 2 days, and over the last year we've averaged 1 day. So, you know, we're trying to stay ahead of that. For the notary program, we have a total of 5 people in that program, a total of 8 people in the UCC program, and so they're small to begin with, by diverting or not allowing the division to operate under a single budget, that really does put both those programs at risk, and that is a concern for us. Prior to the law change that went into effect in 2001, the division had a variety of registration fees, anywhere from $10 to $440 for a business to register. The scheme was fairly complex. It was difficult for a lot of our customers. It was difficult for the division to kind of manage. We were always going back because people would pay the wrong amount, and there was a lot of complexity there. Going to a flat fee worked really well, and if the fee were raised to $50, that would be fairly simple for us to implement. The way we functioned previously, 1999 and back, there was language in ORS 56 that worked very well. We would ask that the committee consider changing the language in section 7, 3, and 5 to that older language, and basically that would allow us to have the operate out of the single budget. The other concern that we had with the language had to do, this is really in sections 8, 9, and 10, has to do with timing and implementation. Right now, the language of the bill says that anybody that pays in December, in the month of December, pays $20. Anybody that pays in the month of January or after would pay $50. Where that gets into a little bit of a problem is that about the middle of November, we're going to start sending invoices out to our customers that are due in January. And we could put any number in there, or a range of numbers, or say if you pay by this date, it's $20. If you wait, it's $50. But one of the things that we do expect is that there's going to be a great deal of difficulty come the first week of January for those customers that received an invoice for $20, and now that's not enough, and it's $50. So we would also like to have you consider that maybe the implementation is based on the anniversary date. The other thing there is if we send out invoices even in December, we're going to start touching people that wouldn't be due until February. And, you know, if they paid in December, it's $20.
Unless we change it.
Right. Unless we went to the anniversary date, and that makes it a little bit cleaner. And anybody, in our sense, anybody that then has a, is by their due date.
That makes sense.
So.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Was there more? No,
well, it's just the other thing that we hear on a pretty regular basis is from the nonprofits, and a lot of the nonprofits in Oregon. There's about 22,000. One of the things that we hear, especially from some of the smaller ones, that people that are just out to do good in their community, even the $20 annual fee can sometimes be a burden for some of them. So $20 is a fairly low amount. That's not all of them, certainly not. And but we do hear that feedback from time to time, and I just wanted to mention that.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. I'd encourage you to work with Mazin if you'd maybe touch base with him on the technical issues and even looking at that language in Section 7, was it?
Section 7.
Yeah, to see if that works and whether that has an impact on the revenue impact. Otherwise, assuming that it may, and if it has any kind of budget implications, whether you may want to pick up something in the reconciliation bill at the end of the session to try closing the loops there. But if we can work it out in this bill, I'd be happy to work with you on that.
I'd
be happy to on that anniversary date amendment. That sounds like it might make more sense than just a calendar date by payment. Representative Berger?
I just want to comment. This is the Revenue Committee. I know we're always talking about the fees in terms of the revenue, but there are other advantages to the state having a registry of some kind on nonprofits, for instance. I think we need to know who's actually doing business, even if it's community good, in the state of Oregon. And because you have to pay something and register, if you're not going to be very legitimate, you might not want to do business in Oregon. You might move on to some other place where they don't keep up with you quite as well. So I just would like to interject that. I think that we shouldn't be all caught up necessarily in the fee because there are other impacts that we have.
Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
And if you'll follow up with Mazin, that'd be great.
Certainly I will. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3656. And let's get back to work session. No, we can't do work session. We don't have a quorum. Where is
2182.
Let's see. Let's recess for just a couple of minutes. Kathy, you can make some phone calls, and let's see if we can. Because we can't do a public hearing. 2182 is set for work session only, right? On the agenda?
Mr. Chair, is it possible for us to do a subcommittee of the regular committee for purposes of
work session? I don't
for
think
purposes
so.
Of considering
it's for work session only.
Work session only. Let's recess. Back to order and open a work session on House Bill 2182. Committee, we heard testimony over the past couple of days on the issue of the nursing home provider tax, and the stakeholders have been out doing some work and getting legal opinions and vetting of the amendments. And I think what we have now are the 14s and 15s to replace the dash 6s. Is that right? Jim Carlson, if you want to come forward. Yes. Oh, Lizbeth.
Yeah.
Hello.
Chairman Shetterly and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with the Dash 14s, this is basically similar to your dash six with some exceptions, but since last time we heard this, I think it would be good to go through some of the details of this provider tax since it is something new. And we may be seeing other ones that are similar to it this session.
So we have.
Yes. So, first of all, this is establishing a provider tax on nursing homes and long-term care facilities with certain facilities that are being exempt. Then it is going to restrict that the maximum amount of that provider tax at 6% of the annual gross revenue of the health care facility subject to the provider tax. It calculates that tax then as the sum of an assessment rate times the number of patient days for each health care facility subject to the tax. Then it requires the health care facility to file a report and pay at the end of the assessment of at the end of each quarter for that assessment to the Department of Human Services. So Human Services will be administering this tax. It provides the Department of Human Services with rulemaking authority to extend the date on which the assessments must be made. And the important point here is there's really a key timing issue with this tax. They have to get approval still for this tax. And so they're most likely not going to meet this first quarter deadline, and so they're going to need authority in order to extend that date for the first payment. It's going to specify that the long-term care facilities are not guaranteed complete reimbursement for the provider tax paid to the state. It requires the Department of Human Services to establish an annual assessment rate. So this assessment rate changes every year, which raises the maximum amount permitted under federal law, excluding those exempt long-term care facilities before. June 15th is a deadline to establish that assessment rate each year. It's exempting the Oregon Veterans Home for this new provider tax. It establishes a penalty then of $500 per day of delinquency if long-term care facilities fail to file a report or pay the assessment, but it also caps then that penalties imposed for each reporting period at 5% of the assessment in that reporting period. It allows a long-term care facility to receive a refund for overpayment of assessment. It provides auditing authority, just like the Department of Revenue has auditing authority. The DHS has auditing authority to determine the compliance with this provider tax. It also specifies that the revenue from the provider tax be deposited first into a suspense account, that is with the DHS, and then after any revenues are taken from that, in order to pay for the refunds, then from there the money is transferred to the treasurer, which is then deposited into a long-term care facilities quality assurance fund. Then at that point there are restrictions on what this fund can be used for. It sunsets the provider tax on July 1st, 2007, so it would only apply for the 03-05 and the 05-07 bienniums. It clarifies that the funds in this account, as well as the federal matching funds, may be used to fund the Medicaid-certified long-term care facilities using only the methodology that is established in this bill. And it outlines that methodology for additional Medicaid reimbursement for long-term care facilities. It allows a periodic adjustment in those reimbursement rates to reflect the increase in long-term care facility caseloads. In the first year, it's actually the assessment rate is actually even set in the bill, and it's set at $8.25. It exempts all continuing care retirement communities as well as certain long-term care facilities that exceed the census level that is established by the department. And at this point, this is something that will need to be decided by the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services to make sure that the department receives the approval for this particular tax, because you're exempting the higher continuing care facilities, which don't have many Medicaid patients, and then you've got to then turn around and also exempt from the tax then these other Medicaid or other facilities that do have high Medicaid census level. And so the census level they're talking is about 90% Medicaid. So it requires the Department of Human Resources to request as a whole a waiver for these different facilities of the broad-based tax requirement, and they will apply to the federal government at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And this is one of the issues with the timing, because this may take a couple months to actually get approval from this before the provider tax would actually be put in place. It requires the department to ensure that the application meets the federal government requirements. So even if it doesn't get approved in the beginning for all waiver, then they will look at ways in which they can revise it in order to get it approved. It repeals the provider waiver tax on January 2nd, 2008. It authorizes a transfer And this is one of the key components that is different from the Dash 6s. The Dash 6s had nothing in it transferring any money to the general fund. You heard testimony that there was a revenue impact of $12.5 million, but it was nowhere in the Dash 6 amendments. So this Dash 14 authorizes a transfer of $6.25 million of long-term care provider tax to the general fund each year, March 15, 2004, and a transfer of $6.25 million of provider tax to the general fund by March 15, 2005. So there is nothing that is set that, you know, $6.25 million has to be some sacred number, but this is what has been arrived at from negotiations. Now, from the revenue impact, originally this was modeled like this. There was going to be $12.5 million taken out in fiscal year 2003, and then the Dash 14s came out that they were going to take out half amount each year for a biennium total of $12.5 million. So what you see here is just a draft revenue impact. There's going to be need to be additional just examination of these, because the important point to recognize here is that each time you transfer money, then you are not going to get as much matching money from the provider tax, and then you are not going to be able to reimburse the Medicaid rates as high. So once you then decrease the amount that you're going to transfer in a given year, then you can have higher Medicaid reimbursement rates, which then feed back into the revenues, because again, this tax is based on gross revenue. So as your reimbursement rates go up, then your gross revenue goes up. So it's a cascading effect where year after year, you're going to see an escalation in revenues, which then escalates the provider tax, which then escalates the Medicaid reimbursement rate, which then turns around again and increases revenue. So any transfers that are made from this provider tax first to general fund does have an effect overall on the total revenues that can be generated from it, because the matching funds for the federal purposes only are matched if the provider tax is used for increasing that Medicaid reimbursement rate. So basically on the back page, you can see this was for a transfer of $12.5 million, and in which case the total provider tax revenue was $48.7 million in the 2003-05 biennium, and a total of $67.3 million in the 2005-07 biennium. These numbers change slightly when you change the timing of this transfer. And then again, you're going to be getting matching funds, which in the 03-05 biennium was estimated $90.8 million, and the 05-07 biennium at $169 million. And as far as the other component, which was the Dash 15, now this is just a totally different calculation for the provider tax. Again, it's a provider tax, but it is for on all-inclusive care for elderly persons. It is one particular provider that would be subject to this at this particular time. So that's what your Dash 15 amendment is doing, is separating out this one PACE provider tax, and that is because there are some legal uncertainties to it, and that's what I'm sure the testimony will be addressing, is with the Dash 15, you do not have any transfer of money to general funds. It's a much smaller tax revenue estimate. It's only at like $718,308 in additional tax revenue for the 03 fiscal year. So the 15 is really a very small portion. It really does not have a real significant effect. It doesn't. Again, these provider taxes, the way the bill is worded, are designed to be exclusively used to increase these Medicaid reimbursement rates. And the only time you're going to have these transfers to the general fund is if you stipulate it. And the legislature can, have these transfers to the general fund, but it's not at all stipulated in the bill. Each year there would be a certain amount of transfers to the general fund.
Okay.
So that's pretty much
the 14s and the 15s. Thank you very much, Elizabeth, for that overview. Jim Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. My colleague, Brett Salmon, here has actually prepared for you a section-by-section analysis of the Dash 14s and the Dash 15s. And what he's done here is that you will note There are some areas that are in bold italics. Those basically outline what were the changes between the earlier amendments and the 14s and the 15s. And essentially what you've got here are some very technical legal issues that were changes that were made to address the concerns primarily of DHS's attorneys, their outside legal counsel from Covington and Burling, and then the Department of Justice attorneys. We have reached agreement on all the technical legal issues in the legislation, I'm happy to report. The one policy issue that is still outstanding is the one that the department stated they still had their concerns with locking the formula, the payment system, or delivery of the dollars into the statute, which is the key provision for our support of this. But on the technical legal issues, the results were positive. The amendments address those issues, dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's. The major change, as Lisbeth indicated, was on the PACE, Program for All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly. Instead of doing this all in one amendment and one account, the state's outside legal counsel felt that it would kind of muddy the waters a little bit on CMS review, so we've totally split that into two separate amendments that will be applied for two separate state plan amendments to the federal government at separate times, which is fine with us as the proponents of the bill and with the folks who operate Providence Elder Place, the PACE site, so that'll be considered on its own merits. And the only other thing I have before being ready to respond to questions would be just indicating on the comments made by staff there about that we get less federal matching money by pulling the 12.5 out before getting Medicaid match. The reason why that is pulled out first is so that that money can be used to buy back other programs in the budget with general fund dollars and still be eligible for match. If we matched it first and then tried to spend the money, the feds would consider that a double match and it wouldn't be permissible. So in order to be able to buy back other human services program reductions or cuts that are eligible for a federal Medicaid match, we have to pull that money out first. And so that's why that is done. Otherwise, you know, obviously we would look to try to maximize federal matching dollars there. But that way you can use those dollars to buy back other Medicaid program items in the budget. And with that, I just want to express my thanks to Legislative Council, to Dexter and Holly in particular, because they've worked very long and hard on this for a number of months, and also to the Department of Human Services staff, who's been working very hard on this. It felt good this morning to finally get to a set of amendments where we had check off on all the technical and legal issues with everything except for the one issue that I indicated earlier where we do have a policy difference between us and the department.
Okay. Mr. Salmon, anything?
Just here to respond to questions.
All right. Representative Verger.
I have a question about the methodology. Where is that found in the bill itself or in one of the amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, if you look on Section 13, Subsection 4 of the amendments, what is done on the payment system methodology is we currently. Yes, it's section 13, okay. Subsection 4.
Okay.
And what we've got currently is we've got the nursing facility reimbursement formula is an administrative rule. This takes largely the same language from administrative rule and it puts it in this bill because since this bill does not technically appropriate the money to nursing facility care, it just generates the tax. We are a little uneasy with allowing the legislation to go forward, not knowing that the dollars are going to go back into the program area, and that's what we've had some discussions.
That's right.
Yeah, and that for us is a key issue. There is one variation between what's currently in rule and what is done in the bill here, and that's what's called in the reimbursement formula the relationship percentage, which basically means right now Medicaid reimburses nursing facilities 90% of the average cost of what it costs to deliver care, according to Medicaid cost reports. We changed the relationship percentage from 90% of average cost to the 63rd percentile in the first, in this biennium. In the second biennium, it goes to the 70th percentile. And what that does, the net effect of that, is currently only one out of every four nursing facilities is reimbursed at a rate that covers their cost under Medicaid. By moving to the 63rd percentile, we get to 6 out of 10 will recover their costs. And in the subsequent biennium, we get up to 7 out of 10 will recover their costs. And what that will do is allow us to do that with additional federal matching funds for no additional general fund commitment. And so we do make forward progress under this bill by utilizing this funding mechanism.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Williams.
I am now out of bamboo to shove under my fingernails. Elizabeth might be able to run out and get us some.
I'm done.
Anybody else?
I understand the feeling.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Sign off from the department on all the legal and technical issues. So really the issue is just whether or not we... It boils down then to the question of in the bill or not in the bill on the reimbursement to the methodology. Okay. Well, committee, what's your pleasure? I'm happy to try and put some of this together, and I want to thank Mr. Carlson and Mr. Sammet for spending most of the day with us waiting for this to come forward. I know they've been working hard to get this down to us. Before I make the motion, I just look up and down the dais. Would there be any objection to the 14s or 15s in the bill?
May I have a question?
Yeah, sure.
This bill isn't ready to move.
No. No.
I don't have any objections.
Yeah, no, we're not. That's all we're doing.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, then. The chair would move the dash 14s to House Bill 2182. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? Hearing none, the 14s are in. Chair would move the dash 15s to House Bill 2182. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? The 15s are in. With that, step forward, committee. We are going to close the work session on House Bill 2182, and we're done for the day.
You need.